Joshua, which are in the book of Parliament, taking Parliament to the people, which was an interesting exercise. Welcome also that you are back alive. We pay our condolences to our late comrade, the Honourable Deputy Minister of Health, Comrade Molefi. There is a memorial service at 12:30 in the old assembly chamber. I also told Mr. Waters, our facilitator, that we will break at 12:25 and just walk down for the service. There was also a notice circulated for the chairperson's meeting between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock in S35, but it's clashing with the memorial service, so we will seek direction from the chief whip on this matter at the memorial service. Honourable members, one apology, that is for Honourable Chani. He is in a plane between Joburg and Cape Town. The flight was delayed, but he will be joining us. And I didn't see the apology, but Committee Secretary Zolani told me that Honourable Harris is in a meeting with the Governor of the Reserve Bank in Pretoria. But I didn't see that as an apology. Honourable members, you will recall when we started our work here last year, June, July, although we came here in May. At one of our meetings, we gave you a lot of information, files. And part of the files was a booklet, Effective Public Accounts Committees. Although we're not public accounts, the basics and the principles for functioning as a committee still stays the same. Today, and this meeting was supposed to have taken place last year already, this workshop, it was just postponed. Because actually when you start with your committee, this must be part of the training. But rather late than never. Committees are also, and members in this committee also serve in other committees, will be dealing with the different budget votes of the departments, and it's also there to sharpen us. The workshop is therefore an attempt to further enhance and improve our role of legislative oversight, especially over the executive by Parliament. An environment where accountability is an integral way of life that contributes to raising the levels of confidence of all society, the electorate, the way we are accountable, organized labor and business as in the system of our democracy. Financial management and corruption and fruitless expenditure of state resources hamper service delivery and the creation of a better life for all our people. The operations of an effective finance and appropriations committee is essential for realizing of this objective. Point is, we must get value for money. And to assist us and to sharpen us, we've got Mr. Kobus Botas here. He's a senior manager in the Office of the Auditor General. Who will be assisting him is Mr. Justin Diedrichs, business executive in the same office, and Mr. Paul Musaka, also in the office of the Auditor General, also business executive. Mr. Musaka will then join us tomorrow. You've got the agenda in front of you. You must also have a file with contents in there. And with these words, Mr. Boetes, I'm going to hand over to you to take us through the workshop. There are some of our members in other committees as well. We try to establish this committee in such a way that our members don't serve on other committees, but it didn't work, but we are here. And I hand over to you. My relationship with this gentleman comes a long, long way, I think from 2000. Yeah. So, and he presented a lot of APEC courses to us when we were still in the legislature. Thank you.
Yeah. I understand that the format of today and tomorrow morning until lunch is the workshop, and therefore, if you are happy with that, we'll be informal and give you opportunity to engage as much as possible. I think we have found that it's when you, as members, start asking the questions that one can address the needs that you have, it's always difficult to prepare, not knowing where to pitch presentations. But the idea is to, in the next day and a half, to take you through some of the basic principles, getting into more detail and more practical dimensions of oversight as we proceed. So the initial part will be really, can I say, academic and principle-based and quite high level. And I'm going to ask you to bear with me because it's a bit theoretical. But we'll be getting further and further into more detail and more practicality, closer to where every day you find yourself in doing your oversight. And then tomorrow we will really try and be practical by giving you examples of reports and challenging you to get out of those reports the useful information that you need to do oversight. Because what is oversight? There are so many definitions of that. But I guess at least it means that it's the activity whereby you are using information, accountability information provided to you as the legislature in order to fulfill that mandate of oversight. And therefore information is probably what it's all about. And information can come packaged in so many different ways and come to you at different times of the year. And we'll be looking at those key phases of oversight in this first presentation. As the chair indicated, I will be joined by colleagues later in the day. There's also a lady joining us, Sharon Adams. She'll be joining us just before lunch, as well as the two gentlemen, Justin and Paul, later this afternoon and tomorrow. They would have appreciated to have been here with us all the time, but they are either busy auditing, and in fact, one of the people audits Parliament. Sharon is the auditor of Parliament, so I think she'll probably creep in here very, you know, very, very low profile and try and leave as quickly as she can. See if we can then start. And you must slow me down if I go too fast, because I also don't want to spend too much time on principles that you're probably quite confident with, but just to bring us all onto the same song sheet. But if I go too fast, you feel free to slow me down. We are looking at legislative oversight, and we'll just be touching again on the principle of the separation of powers, the central role of Parliament in oversight as part of that separation of powers, the actual powers of Parliament, the oversight powers in specific phases of oversight, then look at the oversight cycle and some of the oversight activities, and then we're going to touch on the wonderful new invention of this Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. I've got it right. I think we just always talk about the MBAP, if that's okay with you. And Chair, especially in this first presentation, there are going to be a number of slides that are quite busy, but there's so much process involved that one wouldn't want to necessarily leave some of it out. In this slide, you may have expected to see a triangle, because most of the time, separation of powers is presented in a triangle where you have the three key arms of government being the legislature, the executive, the judiciary. But in South Africa, when the constitution was developed, the fathers who wrote the constitution thought it wise to include what is called Chapter 9 institutions, and they are there created specifically to support democracy, is what the constitution's words are. And therefore, in this particular diagram, you will see that we've included that. And then there are some of the relationships between those institutions. If we can start with Parliament. Parliament is not only the representative of the electorate, but its main functions are to legislate, to put the framework there in terms of which we will operate. And that's also the case in terms of the financial framework, and you're well acquainted with the PFMA and the MFMA. It is also mandated in terms of Section 55 to oversee the executive and the actions of the executive specifically. And then it's a forum for considering and debating and deliberating on issues. And I think that's where the NCOP has such a lot of potential. However, Parliament does not implement. Parliament is not the management, the day-to-day executive government of this country. That power is handed over to the executive. And we have three spheres of government, as you're well aware. The executive, therefore, implements the legislation that you have developed. It also implements and develops policy. That policy, then, during implementation, would need to be coordinated so that there's effective implementation and effective administration of those policies. However, the executive clearly does not legislate. It initiates legislation. We then get to the judiciary, which we're not going to spend much time on, but it is administrating the justice, and in that sense, it enforces the laws that you make. And then we get to the Chapter 9 institutions, and you may be acquainted with them. It's the SA Human Rights Commission, it's the Public Protector, it's the Auditor General. And those Chapter 9 institutions are there to support or uphold constitutional democracy. We are very proud of the Constitution of South Africa. It's probably certainly a benchmark and an example to many constitutions, and then many countries are trying to copy, I think, what we have been able to achieve in that sense. These institutions, these Chapter 9s, are independent and impartial and subject to the Constitution and the law, and they include the Auditor General. However, they are not so impartial and so independent that they're not accountable. They are also accountable to Parliament itself, and we'll get into that a little bit later. The relationships then between these four circles, if we can call it that, is one of Parliament conferring responsibilities onto the executive. And the executive, as you know, will be the minister who then confers responsibilities downwards into the department. And then it starts to be called delegations later on. With these executive responsibilities that the minister and his departments, the director general and the departments have, the officials, they execute and administer policy, but they are called upon by Parliament, normally at the end of a year at least, to give account and to give accountability reports. And Section 92 of the Constitution actually requires of the ministers to at least annually provide such a accountability report, and mostly that takes the form of the annual reports that you are aware of. The Auditor General's relationship with the executive is that where the financial administration takes place, the Auditor General would audit that, inspect that, if you wish, to give assurance to the legislature, because that reporting that's happening on an annual basis is then verified, if you wish, by this independent institution or agency called Auditor General, so that the information that you as members get you have a sense of whether you can rely on this as verified enough to be able to act upon and make decisions and call to account. So it's all about information, as we said at the beginning. The relationship between the Chapter 9 and the Auditor General and Parliament is that these audit reports are then provided to you in different forms and shapes, and we'll speak about the types of audits that we have and where you would necessarily find them. One of the welcoming elements of the Constitution in Chapter 9 is that all the arms of government, whether it's Parliament, the Executive or the Judiciary, is supposed to assist and protect the Auditor General and the other Chapter 9 institutions. I think it's more or less the same principle as cooperative governance. We have therefore... Yes.
No, I'm going to write this for this. Yes. There has been a small little argument about the relationship between Parliament and the Department, where there was an assertion that says the DGs and others were saying, no, Parliament only knows the ministers to come and account. And then another version was saying, no, the DGs. But what I'm looking at on what you have is that it looks like Parliament only knows the politicians in the executive. And I'm not sure what is your position on that particular matter when it comes to accountability.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. This is a, as you say, it's an interesting discussion, and it's a big debate also internationally in terms of exactly what does accountability look like in practice. And in fact, in Canada, they separate accountability from answerability, to account to or to answer to. Now we're starting to split hairs, of course. But I think the Constitution is quite clear that the accountability relationship at the highest level is between the legislature and the executive, being the members of the national government, provincial, or even in municipal level, between the council itself and the mayoral committee or the executive of the municipality. But we also know that on a daily basis, those who execute and administer and implement policy are the officials, and they have various tiers of authority and seniority. So I think the question is, what would the parliamentary structure who is engaging be trying to achieve? Because at times it would make no sense to engage with an official if it's a clear policy related matter, etc. If it's a matter of gathering information, which again at the beginning we said information is such a key empowering and enabling element of your work, then you would as a committee resolve where best to obtain that information. Now that's what the Canadians call. Therefore, officials are answerable to Parliament, and the Constitution gives you the power to call anyone to provide you with the information that you require. So I guess, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, except to say that whether you're gathering information or whether you're holding accountable, I think one needs to see what you need in order to do that. Because if you're purely holding accountable, you may have already gathered information and you may then want to engage in an accountability relationship, saying, for example, Minister, maybe I'm not too happy with the information I received from your department. Now I have to turn to you. But I don't think it's a simple matter of either this or that. I think there are gradual levels of accountability relationships, and I think that there are also phases of it. For example, yes, engage with the, in the case of Scopo, engage with the Director General, send the information you need. Once you have the information you require, and you may even get it from the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer, during that process, or from the Audit Committee of the Department, you have enough information to apply your mind to the situation or the problem, and you may then want to engage the member of the executive for whatever reason. But I think we can only interpret the Constitution, and the Constitution is quite clear in terms of the accountability. In fact, we'll do it in the second part of this morning's presentations. We'll cover the Constitution quickly through those elements as well. The Auditor General has...
Just on what Michelle has just said. It's just that we can even ask information from the CFO or the DGs and all that. Why is it only important then for us only to concentrate on the finance side and not, or will it take us through this, during this 1.5 day, that only the finance to see the output as well?
I certainly think that, that oversight is far more than just financial oversight. Definitely, and the Auditor General will be, we will also explain to you when Justin Diedrichs is here this afternoon, he will explain to you what our auditing of performance information, non-financial information, is all about. But we also firmly believe, as auditors, that if there isn't good financial administration, you can't even start service delivery. And that's probably why we would be concentrating as we do on the basic financial audits as a basic responsibility of our government. Chair, we have therefore members adopted what we call our reputation promise or our mission statement, and we're merely saying that the Auditor General therefore has a constitutional mandate and responsibility as the supreme audit institution of South Africa, and that is that we exist strengthen our country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability, and good governance, but through auditing. We are not the Human Rights Commission, we are not the Public Protector, we are not the prosecuting authority, so we can blow the whistle, but we can't arrest. If we then look at some of the parliamentary powers that exist. In the first column, we look at the legislative powers. The second column is looking at the budgetary powers. And both of these powers are applied at two stages of the year. And these are terms that I hope you will be comfortable with, because it's so commonly used in literature that we've tried to get away from these terms ex ante and ex post, but it really explains it quite succinctly. And it really just says ex ante is before the fact and ex post is after the fact. And what that means in practical terms for oversight is that as a legislature, there's a lot of engagement before the year starts, before the budget's approved, before the strategic plans are signed off by Parliament or approved by Parliament. But once that is done, the financial year then runs out eventually, and then there is the year end, or ex ante, which is after the year, after the events have taken place, where you have your classical oversight of what has already taken place. So if we look at the legislative powers in the ex ante phase and before the event, we'll see that Parliament has the powers to scrutinize, amend, adopt or reject legislation clearly, as well as policy papers, And in a slide, two slides from this one, we'll look at the cycle and where the policy phase takes place, and then as we continue throughout until the end of the year. The legislative powers would then apply after the event in the left bottom block there, and that is to monitor and hold accountable the executive. And the power is provided in the Constitution and also in the Powers and Privileges of Parliament Act to comply with legal instruments or for the performance that you're expecting the executive to implement. And that's the effectiveness issues that the member just referred to. During the budgetary phase, or in terms of the budgetary powers, the legislature has the power to scrutinize, amend, adopt, and reject the budget proposals. And as you know, it's a very new thing to Parliament. Everyone, I think, is still trying to understand quite a difficult process. Internationally, it's a very difficult process, I understand. And I think we're all excited to see how Parliament can get on top of this, but it's certainly going to take quite a while. It does not mean that you are actually budgeting. That is the function of the executive. You are merely having some influencing or amending powers to the budget. And I think that a little bit of literature that we've looked at saying that in certain countries, you know, the extent to which you can amend the budget differs from very, very little to a little bit more, but it's not necessarily extensive. Because after all, your responsibility is not to run the country on a daily basis, and therefore the budget responsibility, the drawing up, because a budget is nothing but a plan. Budget planning, which is a detailed, extremely detailed, and extremely onerous process, is in the hands of those who are supposed to know what it's about. After the end of the budget process, you have the power and should be monitoring the budget implementation so that you can hold the executive to account for using the funds as authorized by yourselves and in terms of the value achieved for those funds spent. And that's the performance dimensions that we'll look at a bit later. Just to go
I'm just a little bit inquisitive about what you said. When you say it does not equal the power to budget, because when you amend the budget, I believe that is an activity of budgeting for that particular item. I'm not sure. Under which context are you really saying this? Because also, the extent to which we can amend the budget, I'm not sure that there is somewhere where there is any limitation. If maybe I can be helped where that limitation is implied, maybe. Because if it happens that, like what happens, I think, in Mpumalanga the past year, that they did almost a major overhaul of the budget. And if more than 50% of the budget is amended, then it will be extensive. But if there is somewhere where there is a limitation to the extent to which Parliament can amend the budget, maybe if I can be helped just to try and get informed on that particular matter. But that's simply to change the budget, whatever line. I thought that it means that Parliament is budgeting for that particular line, if it changes it. Whether this statement relates to the total budget, I'm not sure. If I could just be helped there. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I think that's a very interesting question. I think it's to do with the detailed construction of the budget, which Parliament would not ever endeavour to get into, and the budget process would you know build up from a huge amount of detail and eventually come into a summary budget, which is what's presented to yourselves as Parliament. So there would be extensive further detailed budget working papers, so to speak, sitting behind what you are provided and which you would then be able to amend. But I think it's probably wordplay in the sense that you will be amending the budget, but you won't be developing the budget. And it's only the Minister of Finance that has the authority under the Constitution to develop the national budget. I think it's that. But what I'm going to ask you, Kasi, is just for us to check whether we can give you absolute detail on the limitations and exactly how those limitations work in terms of what you are or whether you are limited and to what extent you are limited in terms of the budget process.
I think that you are limited in amending budgets insofar as keeping to the fiscal framework. You're not supposed to go outside that. You must be in line with those principles. And that's the main thing. You have to be in line with the fiscal framework in order to be able to amend it. Outside that, you are not going to be able to. And that, too, is not an easy matter because committees have to do a lot of work trying to analyze and the budget and interpret it correctly. You know, much as we have powers to amend, but going into it is not going to be an easy process in terms of the fiscal framework as a whole. You know, that's what is required of us to do, generally. I'm saying this is a limitation, but at the same time, if there are compelling reasons, you know, let's say a certain department needs some emergency funds for some reason, I don't think that would be impossible to do if we talk as a committee, to Parliament, and convince the minister as well. Because one thing also, we need to really convince each other that there is a need to do a particular thing. But it's not just open-ended process. It is not like that at all. Thank you.
Thank you, that helps a lot. And I mean, after all, the fiscal framework is also something that Parliament had approved at some point.
Yes.
And therefore, I think it's just about the manageability of the process, because a budget is an extremely detailed process and a very lengthy process. And I think if Parliament, I don't want to say were permitted to, but if there was an opportunity at that very late stage to start changing so extensively that one would really have to go back to the beginning of the process, then one will never get the budget dispensed with. But I will also just see if there are any percentage limitations on any of the main divisions or whatever, because I know that internationally some are permitted to amend, but not more than 5% of certain totals.
Yeah, I think what you're now talking to is exactly what I wanted to know, whether there is anywhere where there is that particular limitation. The limitation that has been raised by my comrades at the back, I'm aware of that one. By the time we receive the budget, already that budget is limited by that fiscal framework. But then I'm talking about anything that talks to Parliament amending the budget, which is within the fiscal framework, but amending it to 100%.
Right.
That's what I was. That's exactly what I was referring, because I'm not aware of any sentence that talks to that. But what this sentence or this position that you've raised in here, then it should be based on something. And then that's what I actually want to know. On what is it based? If sometime during the day we can get briefings, fine.
We'll get back to you. Yeah. Thank you. Just to drill down a little bit deeper, then, Jay, in terms of the financial oversight, there are three key phases. It's the ex ante, we're in the left column. And we're looking at the financial or fiduciary dimensions of oversight. Where just before the financial year commences, you would be scrutinizing the financial forecast or the budget, how much money will be used, by whom, for which type of input. In other words, in the planning phase of government, are they going to be doing things, in terms of your judgment, correctly, so that they can deliver that which those policies and those service delivery imperatives that you have agreed to. During the year, as the departments then implement their budgets on a monthly basis, you can be monitoring the use of the money. Is the spending on track? Will it be more or less? Will they be overspending? What are they heading towards? And is the spending happening in terms of what you had approved as the purposes for which that money is meant? And I'm not sure to what extent yourself as a committee are monitoring the spending of any of the government's sphere of government, but there is information provided on a monthly basis in terms of the spending, and that in itself is quite a taxing responsibility, Chair.
We receive reports from the National Treasury on a quarterly basis,
right,
on the spending on special conditional grants by the departments, and then also the spending by municipalities. And we're actually starting on the 20th, the Select Committee on Appropriations calling provinces, departments, sports, arts and culture, the spending on the grant on libraries, health, revitalization grants, all them in. In terms of the report given to us by National Treasury.
And it's probably, Chair, members, more manageable, because to try and monitor on a monthly basis is very taxing. But quarterly seems to make more sense, it's a bit more pragmatic, and it's probably something that you would be able to manage.
I just want to go back to the previous page. It will be the ideal situation when you deal with the budget of a department to go back to the previous annual reports and to see how was the spending related to the priorities and the annual performance plan, and then look at the present budget and must adjustments be made or not. That is the ideal situation.
That
but because of capacity, we can't do it.
That is the ideal.
And
I think that what we'll also share with you tomorrow when Paul Mutaka is here is the Auditor General is trying to make your life a little easier by providing what we call general reports, reports where we try and consolidate a lot of this perspective so that you might have a quicker bird's eye perspective that you may benefit from. Because, yes, to try and make that assessment with respect to these dozens of government departments is going to be very, very difficult. But we'll share with you some of those general report features and so tomorrow. And I think the other thing, of course, that we know is that the budget office, which you are, as a legislature, trying to set up is critically important, because that's where your research capacity will lie, and they would have to empower the members and enable the members to have information that you wouldn't have the time to process. And then just again, Chair, in terms of the financial fiduciary oversight dimensions, after the end of the year, the ex post phase, I'm at the left bottom pink block, is the scrutiny of financial outturns or outcomes by main categories of the financial classification. And the question then is, was there compliance with Parliament's appropriation? Did they spend, in terms of the purposes for which the money was intended, did they spend within the limits which you set as Parliament by approving the budget? On the non-financial side, or the results side, or the service delivery side, which is certainly so important, you would be scrutinizing the forecasts or the plans that are presented to you in terms of the achievements that they are foreseeing, that they are projecting to achieve. What is the taxpayer's money going to be expected to buy? In other words, is government aiming to achieve the right things? And the strategic plans are critical documents, and I think the chair was just mentioning to me that sometimes you don't get those plans that long in advance. But yes, it's the idea is for you to be able to influence those service delivery objectives and projections as well. During the year, you could then, as a legislature, scrutinize the achievements of the spending during the year on those specific service delivery objectives, the pace of the implementation of those policies and the legislation as projected in the budget documentation. And at the end of the year, once the financial year has come to an end and there's been an auditor general is going to try and provide you with some perspective in that regard as well in the future, you'll scrutinize the actual achievements. What did the money buy? What did government achieve? And in terms of what it said it would, and was the money used efficiently and effectively? And as you may know, it's always important when you evaluate is to not only look at what was achieved, but also what was it intended initially. And those two have to be always comparing, so it's actual against intended or forecasted or planned. Here, this slide is from another angle, illustrating the various phases of oversight. And the process or the oversight cycle, and one can also include the financial cycle. The policy development happens at the beginning. And you would have a green paper, you'll have a white paper, and eventually the policy might become legislated, or it might merely become something that the budget plan then reflects. The strategic planning is getting into a little bit more detail, but it's still quite a high level. But yes, that's at a sufficient level for you as legislators. Because remember, you're not managers. You are legislators. And therefore, you would mostly function at a strategic level. And I think we're always quite impressed with the manner in which members are able to function strategically. And often, I think our problem with our audit staff, who are very operational in management, is that they can't make that adjustment to engage with the legislature, because they're thinking operationally, and the members are thinking strategically, and your vision is normally long-term, more than a year, while we work with financial years and months and quarters, you know. Yes, so there's the strategic planning phase, which Parliament would then also be involved in, where specific performance indicators are specified, and that's so critically important. Because if one can get it right at the beginning, then it's really a matter of implementation. But if you're off the target, if you're off track at the beginning, you might implement as efficiently as possible, but you're implementing for inefficiency, or maybe not for the right deliveries. The operational planning is then where the officials come in. They must take the policy and the strategy, and they must operationalize that. And for that, they are trained and they're well paid. And yes, hopefully they will be held accountable, firstly by the minister and by yourselves as well. They set targets and allocate resources. And throughout the year, we're at the bottom of that circle now, throughout the year they will then implement. And they will have to report on a monthly basis, first of all, management to themselves. So you'll hear the Auditor General, we hope that November can be seeing you quite soon in the next maybe 6 weeks just to share some of the municipal outcomes with you. And you'll see one of the first things, three main elements that he always shares is sometimes getting it right is so simple because it's just about reporting on a monthly basis what you as management have done. Basic little records, simple bookkeeping, consolidating that on a monthly basis, getting it to top management of the department so that they can look at this and say, we are on track, and so that they can come to you, the legislator, at a very higher level now, especially in those quarterly reports, to say we are or we are not on track. But so often where it goes wrong is that on a monthly basis, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, the officials aren't managing their documentation properly. They're not capturing that which is being done because financial records is nothing but a story about what has happened, what was it that took place. And you would find that they start putting the story together at the end of the year, then it's far too late. Because the question remains, what were they monitoring themselves in terms of their own progress? Did they know whether they were making progress? As you are driving from Cape Town to Simonstown, you would know that you're probably now 12 kilometers down the road, you probably have another 11 left, and you are just about to get onto the Blue Route. You know that because you've got a speedometer, you've got your own monitoring systems, your eyes, you're now just off the side of Duval onto Blue Route, or otherwise you'll be driving in the dark. And it's really about capturing throughout the year that information which would be telling them whether they're on track, how far are they down the line. And that's often where oversight is so valuable, because if they know there's a committee in Parliament that will be asking them very hard questions after the first quarter, after the second quarter, we hope that they would be fulfilling that accountability role throughout the year. It all builds up to a 12-month record. And I think when the Auditor General tells you that he had to qualify the statement, the one reason he'll give you is that because once the statements were received, the supporting records were just so poor and so uneven and so erratic that you can't rely on it. And that's the main function when it comes to record keeping and telling the story that officials have to comply with. So it's implementation throughout the year. And from an oversight perspective, you have certainly an important role to play. And I guess it would be challenging to you to see how, because you've got a wide scope of work, where to really focus your priorities, because some areas are more problematic than others. At the end of the year, yes, excuse me.
No, I was going to say that the only limitation around implementation is the assistance to Parliament itself, to parliamentarians, in terms of backup information, factual information about projects, in various centres.
Yeah.
Whether we get that information from NGOs or from our own research units, this is limiting. As a result, you only, the third element would be the feedback directly from the people themselves, the recipients, And there's a limitation to that working here. That's why sometimes we become shocked when we see the protests in various communities. Because how did this happen? And yet, you said maybe a month ago, and you received a report that said that project is going on well.
Yeah.
I have that dilemma sitting here. How do we really compare and relate this information to our work here, so that what we say here is what is happening on the ground? You know, perhaps we need to do more work as legislators to make sure that we close that gap. You know, thank you.
Chair, I can't do more. Maybe let's take the next one as well.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried. Yes, I was just thinking that maybe because this is the cause of the problems with municipalities, record keeping, and rigging of source documents by whoever scrupulous other officials. Then I've been thinking whether it is. Is it not because our structures of administration entrust the responsibility of receiving source documents by the most junior and qualified officials? Where a person pays the money and gets a receipt, it happens with the most junior official, who is vulnerable, that even those documents, even if she or he puts in a file, a senior official can still come and take a receipt and throw it away if that receipt is dangerous in whatever form. Then I'm just checking with you whether is it not time that we must think about putting senior officials at our front line, where these particular things are happening. The same thing that I'm saying, I'm sure, about 15 years back, I had a discussion about the police station to say, why don't we put the most senior policeman at the charge office? Who must dictate where things must go and things must happen? Because even at the police service, they put most junior officials on the count. And that's problematic. Because then it actually creates a situation where there is no certainty and security of the source documents that the upper echelons would expect them to flow to them and make all the necessary analysis and reporting. That's what was just going through my mind, whether it is a thing, I don't know.
He'd like to ask.
Yeah, so Honorable Mashila, I'm tempted to answer this, you know, quickly, and it's an interesting dimension. For me, the answer is management and leadership, and it's got nothing to do with ranks. You know, if there are managers in an institution, if there's leadership in an institution, it does not matter what rank you are, whether you are lowest handling receipts there and filing them properly, and or highest, where you are supposed to account for the activity of your division, your section. You know, that's where the problem is at the moment. You know, people fail to account, and they blame all other systems. You know, and if we have systems and accountability. I would make you an example. At some point in my life, I was a cashier for a few years. You know, most of the cashier you receive money and so on. You keep records, bookkeeper, so to speak. I did that without failing. And I worked there for many years. There was no point at which my boss would come, say, I want that particular documentation or books, cash books and so on, would I say, I don't know where they are. At no point. I left that place many, many years ago, but I know that there was no stage where I would say, I don't know where they are. There was no stage where, after every month end, where I'm supposed to reconcile the cash books, I was going to say, no, I could not do it because you know I was away and so on. On the seventh day of each month, those cash books were ready and be passed on to another section. That is now the bigger reconciliation bookkeeping section. They would receive those cash books and make the point that all transactions are accounted for. In the areas where the Auditor General would pick up issues regarding the systems and so on, would then be able to come back and answer those questions to the satisfaction of the Auditor General, you know, so that that informal query, what you call today letters, management letters, would then be dispensed with. It would not become a formal query or as an audit query at the end of the day. I'm saying if we're all responsible in our respective areas, we would not have this kind of problem, what we have today in various municipalities, like the Honorable Scouting, or any other provincial department for that matter. Because if you get a disclaimer in a particular financial year, you would make means to correct that. And in the next financial year, you would get a clean report. Why wouldn't you? Because there are people there and who are paid to do that. I'm saying it's management.
It's a very good example. I think when Mr. Nombembe engages you again, the other of the three elements that he has identified, because he looks at the fact that you find you have a basic common audit finding that says record keeping is poor. But the question is why? And one of the other reasons that he has isolated is management involvement, taking clear responsibility for the various levels at which you function, and he's called it leadership involvement from the mayor, from the premier, by the way, throughout, right up to the lowest level of official. Because I think it would be an answer what you are proposing, but it's not affordable, because then you'll be paying very high salaries to people doing quite a straightforward task. However, if there is sufficient leadership involvement and accountability is clear and personal, often what they call it, then there should be better management. And I think, just to come back to yourselves, as the highest level of management of South Africa Incorporated, is to be saying, but are the people that you oversee involved enough on at the level at which they operate? And that would be the executive and the directors general and those high level officials. Because where the minister is actively involved in things like audit reports and audit outcomes, we find things go well. Where it's a bit more hands off, then it's not going that well. And it applies at each and every level of operation. Did I miss a question?
I wanted just to support the statement of Mr. Mashiro of a senior person in the front desk. Mm-hmm. You know why? Let me just give you an example. In the olden days, when you accept sometimes admission of guilt from the, you see, an ordinary sport file locally. Nowadays, it is so cumbersome because you have to take that ticket to the jurisdiction of that municipality who gives you the ticket. But in the old days, there was a senior person at the church office checking on those admission of guilt, channeling them properly to the proper call. Sometimes it's Alberton, you send it straight and there they will account. Same type of, it's where we are losing resources, I mean to say finance. It's just lying around in the country. You find that no,
we can't function nicely. That's why his budget is concerned.
And I think where the member is absolutely correct is that although perhaps the senior shouldn't be physically carrying out the everyday transactions, he should be there physically. She should be there. Because her eyes and his eyes as supervisor will be all over. But he can't be in the back of his office. And never they see him and never does he see them. And I think it's that responsibility and involvement and that leadership that is required. I actually don't know if I should get into this slide. This is such, you know, but let me just share this with you. Parliament's oversight process is not simple. And I think this slide demonstrates that. There are so many role players, there are so many processes, and there's so much information. If you look at the middle of the slide, it just separates into the three phases again. You've got your ex ante or before the beginning of the year. During the year is the in-year oversight, and then there's ex post oversight. But without spending too much time on that detail, I think it does indicate to you that you've got your portfolio committees, you've got your select committees, the appropriation committees are there, and the finance committees all have a different roles to play. You've got the public accounts committee at the end there as well. And if you look at the bottom of this slide, the National Treasury is providing a lot of information to you, the MTBS in November, the Finance and Fiscal Commission's report. Then the National Treasury comes with a host of other information to yourselves. The departments are tabling certain information. Then during the year, Treasury publishes these monthly Section 32 reports and those quarterly reports that you are already receiving. And remember, that information is produced by the departments. So at the same time, you can engage the departments about the details sitting behind that. And maybe just before I forget, I think one of the things we've learned over the years is that one of the ways for you to be a little bit more effective is when you require information, to demand it in a format that you are comfortable with and that enables you to do your work, and not allow them to give you an 80-page memo or an 80-page document of whatever sort. And departments, of course, know that that's one way to tire you out and to make you less efficient. So they will come, it's important, Chair, it's important to say, no, that's fine, make it an annexure, but I want a 3-page from you telling me the following, and then you stipulate what you want. Treasury tries to help by requiring the financial statements to be in a certain format, the annual report to be in a certain format, strategic plans to contain certain information, and to their best ability, by listening to you and by talking to you, Treasury has tried to come up with that format. The problem is once you start engaging with the departments, that's when they dump you with a lot of, they ground you with a lot of information. And you have the right, Section 55 gives you the right to ask for information from anyone. But Section 55 should also have said is in the format that Parliament chooses. I think that certainly is your right.
So, but there, on that very issue, arising the format Parliament chooses, I know that everything has been standardized now. Treasury playing a leading role in saying this is the kind of information I want from the department in this particular format. We tried that in the province recently for many years to say as a legislature over and above what Treasury wants in terms of the format. This is what we want. And we got a lot of resistance until we literally abandoned that scheme and used the Treasury, National Treasury wants as a standard. And up to now, all departments, in fact, all legislatures use the national standards drawn up by Treasury. Because they were saying, there are many issues that they were raising. even the premier in our case got involved to say, look, these are implementing departments, and they now tell you how they implement. If you change that format, no longer their responsibility now to account in the manner in which the legislature wants, because the National Treasury and the Department are in fact implementing in a particular fashion, and they are drawing reports in a particular fashion. So oversee them using that particular format, they know. And they don't try to draw your own. And then we stopped, and we left it at that. And,
The guidance by Treasury in terms of the format is partly where you should start. Because after all, Treasury is appointed to be the central regulating authority, if you wish, in terms of information, at least. And I think if you engage Treasury and convince them of your needs, then they're supposed to improve it accordingly and based on your need. I must say that, and this was in the National Assembly and some of the committees here, but I must say that I was a bit worried that sometimes when Treasury does come for consultation and say that this is the latest Treasury regulation, would you members like to improve? What do you want? And the members then don't engage. And then Treasury goes away, and they've got to do it as best as they think. They understand the needs of Parliament. But I think that in the little guideline that Mr. De Beer referred to, one of the efficiency factors identified there is that you influence at every level, at the legislative level, at the regulation level, and at the format level of information that comes your way, that you influence frameworks. And that has to be through the designated administrators or regulators, in this case, either the Treasury or provincial Treasury. And again, it's the question is, if you go back to this, if we look at the top ex ante stage, the green stage, up front, if you can influence, your effectiveness will probably snowball. It takes time. You cannot come to a meeting about the latest draft Treasury regulation and not have spent 3-4 hours having studied that. And that is difficult, I know. Your time is so short. But yes, again, where is your impact probably going to be most effective? Because you can sit and be frustrated for many meetings, receiving department information that to you is not usable. Whilst if you could spend 2 full days engaging Treasury in an informed way, leaning on your research capacity, challenging your research capacity to assist you to really engage them so that you can really pinpoint those issues that really matter. What the AG is going to try and do, Mr. Didrich will explain a little bit more about that, but we're going to try and audit service delivery information and also talk about the reliability of that information and the appropriateness or relevance of that information. But again, you set the framework, but now you've delegated to Treasury that responsibility. So PFMA says that's Treasury's job. So you've delegated that. So now you've got to engage with your delegatees in terms of what you want. But you've got the right to, certainly. And I think they want to. But they need you to really engage them robustly.
But the one thing that I think that we just need to raise, I think I've been here through the third parliament.
Yeah.
I was around here.
and the relationship between Parliament and Treasury, I think, has been at the lowest during the third Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Has been at the lowest. And the basis of that has been the Department of Treasury acting as a super department. And it has been difficult, very difficult. And probably, I'm sure you'll understand, if you have, if you follow the debate about the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, those debates in any committee in the NA or the NCOP, it was informed by that particular level of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And Treasury has been very problematic, very bossy, arrogant, and all sorts of names that you can have that defines a person that doesn't cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of late, I think, since the 2007, I think things started a little bit changing, and then therefore one would understand the problem that Comrade Matuziwa had in the province. Treasury was untenable at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was untenable,
and that was preventing.
Yes, it's Treasury was just dictating across.
Mm-hmm.
It's either you agree with them, if you don't, then they throttle you all the way. So you'll understand why even the Premier will be forced to comply when they are in those particular meetings with Treasury, that they get influenced. But at the end of the day, is correct what you have said. How do you do oversight over a department or over a section on the information that is not in the format that you understand to be able to take decisions? It becomes a bit of a problem. And we hope that the department, it is easing up, and it is becoming part of other departments, like other than the superpower departments.
Okay, maybe just to... I can't really comment too much about that, except to say that I think we've been having very good cooperation from Treasury. The current Auditor General is very serious about the fact that you can't work in isolation. There's close cooperation. I think Sharon has just joined us. At the back, that's Sharon that's going to present just after me. Even the relationship with the provincial treasuries are improving. The capacity within those treasuries are improving. But if we could come back to the question you raised earlier, who do you actually engage with as Parliament? Maybe the head of Treasury is the Minister.
Yeah.
And if he understands your needs and your agenda, then maybe it will go a little bit better at the second tier and third tier of those guys. Eventually you will be working with in more detail. But yes, as the House of the NCOP, I'm sure that you can convince the Minister of your needs and your priorities, you know. I think we have found that if you engage directly at a certain level, which might be two tiers down from the top guy, obviously you be a little more frustrated than the ones who know how where the priorities lie. Sharon, do you want to join me up front? I'm going to finish. I don't think... on your slide, there's a bit of information about the Money Bills Amendment and Procedures and Related Matters Act, but we're at the beginning of a long, epic, and exciting, I would suggest, development, and we're not the experts on that, but I think that suffice to say that it has given Parliament an opportunity to be even more effective when it comes to oversight, because the one argument is that ability that you do now have to amend really focuses everyone's attention, because the processes leading up to that, the processes following on that and coming back again. In fact, let's just return to this slide. If you look at the important little words on the on the top left, it says, after the end year reporting, you assess and you adjust. Now, if you are not happy, you would demand adjustment in whatever way, but certainly the budget is one of those. And that's your power. Plus, of course, your ability to call to account, and that may mean raising issues, if necessary, in public, about which you are unhappy. Chair, I thank you. I think that's the first presentation that I think if we want to make sure that you are able to attend the service at 12:25, if we can try and get to Sharon as quickly as possible, what I was going to do next, and let me just show you what that is, and then you'll advise me on the extent of detail that you would like to go into that, was the statutory framework within which financial oversight takes place. But I think I have a suspicion that you may be well acquainted with this, but we can go through that. Let me do that, and then you'll advise me on the extent to which you would want to engage on that. I was just going to touch on the Constitution, the PFMA, MFMA, and the Public Audit Act, just to give us, again, the basis from which we can proceed as we go along. The principle of oversight starts with Section 1 of the Constitution, which requires not only a multi-party system of democratic government, but also accountability that must be ensured by this. So accountability is a key principle, a Section 1 principle of our constitutional framework. Thank you. Yeah. Page 4 of the presentation. All members have copies. Then in Section 41, in terms of the principle of cooperative government, which is critically important because we have three spheres of government, those three spheres of government must make things work. And but even in terms of those principles of cooperative governance, there's the requirement that all organs of state in each of the spheres of government has to provide effective, transparent, and accountable coherent government. So accountability is, again, a central value. The NCOP may, and this I think you are well acquainted with, summon any person, require any institution to report to it, or receive petitions, presentations, submissions. And I think we spoke about that just now. I mean, it's a constitutional right that you have to obtain this information, and as I said, in a manner and in a form that you would demand. The Constitution also talks about the accountability of the members of Cabinet, collectively and individually to Parliament, and then this further obligation of reporting Parliament, or providing Parliament on a regular basis with full and regular reports concerning matters under their control. And that applies at the municipal level as well. We must not forget that there's a National Revenue Fund, which is where it's a national purse, and you hold that purse strings, and you only let them go when the minister convinces you with the budget in February to let go of those purse strings. But it's important to understand that it can only be done through an act of parliament or through what is called a direct charge against the National Revenue Fund. But the Appropriation Act of Parliament is the core document, the core law that allows the spending of public monies. And therefore you have this absolute right to demand accountability for what was done in terms of that allocation or appropriation. The Auditor General then comes in Chapter 9, Section 188, and is charged with the responsibility to audit all three spheres of government, to departments and entities, municipalities and other institutions or accounting entities required by law to be audited. And the Auditor General can't only audit and keep quiet. He has to publicly bring that information to you, again, in a form that hopefully is useful to you. And as much as what we spoke about previously applies to the Auditor General, we would certainly appreciate feedback from you about our report, especially the general report that we'll be looking at tomorrow. All reports must be made public because in the South African Constitution, transparency is another core value. And you will find it interesting how many countries don't have absolute transparency as far as the auditing of government accounts are concerned and the processes that follow on that. Just again, the NCOP's ability to get involved through the Section 110 and 139 interventions. And that's a wonderful opportunity for you to apply your oversight role and to have an impact on South Africa's management of its resources and its service. And then we come to the well-known Public Finance Management Act. I'm not going to go into detail. It is there to regulate the public finance at public finances at the national and provincial level. But what I would like to share with you is just an interesting fact that you have to bear in mind. The PFMA is not an accountability act. In fact, initially it was introduced into Parliament as the Treasury Control Bill. It's about control by Treasury over state finances and processes. If Parliament wants to improve accountability, they need not, or they should not, only look at the PFMA as the core framework. It's a financial management framework. And the answers are not necessarily all going to be in the PFMA. And again, you could apply your mind and consider where you could influence the frameworks that exist, such as the Powers and Privileges of Parliament Act. Of course, the Money Amendments Bill, Money Bills Amendment Procedure Act is a wonderful example of how you are now putting in place your own legislation to influence. Just one element from the Public Finance Management Act is the obligation of producing annual reports in a specific format containing specific information that should enable you to conduct oversight. The reporting framework is prescribed by National Treasury, so they are the ones to influence. And a key feature of the accountability process is to report against intended or predetermined performance, whether it's financial performance, which is the budget, or whether it's service delivery performance, which would be the strategic and operational plan. And the PFMA does try to provide regular information and other processes in terms of which you can then access that information, in terms of which that information is supposed to be disclosed to you by those who are in charge of the money and the administrative processes. The Section 32 reports that you get 30 days after the end of each month and that Treasury publishes in the Government Gazette, the quarterly information that you already access. Section 38 to 42 is an extensive section about the responsibilities that the accounting officers have. That if ever you need to call an accounting officer to a specific account, you can go and look at those sections and you can see that it's quite an onerous obligation to be the accounting officer of the department. Financial misconduct in sections 81 to 86. I'm not sure if we often enough go to those sections to see what the frameworks and the processes which they provide for. And then just to note that Treasury regulations, quite detailed Treasury regulations, support the PFMA. So the PFMA is not all that there is. In fact, Sharon can advise, but I think that often the devil is in the detail that's in the regulations. For example, with regard to audit committees, the internal audit function, risk management. The thief may just flag that in the regulations that you find a lot of the detail. The NSMA more or less the same objectives as the PSMA, just at the municipal level. I was interested to note again that that you are supposed to receive a Section 48 report from the MECs and the Minister of COGTA. That's supposed to provide you with some good information. I'm not sure to what extent you access that and focus on that. There are a few sections that are interesting in the PSMA, the primary responsibility for resolving financial problems in 135, the types of provincial interventions as well as the discretion of provincial interventions in section 137, and then the criteria for determining what serious financial problems constitute. Just a quick wrap-up in terms of the Public Audit Act. The Public Audit Act replaced the old Auditor General Act, and it really just fleshes out Chapter 9, especially Sections 188 and 181 of the Constitution, to provide a detailed legal framework for the Auditor General within which to operate. We trust that the Act is a more modern framework for the Auditor General to really be providing you with world-class audit services, and we would like to believe that we are one of the leading audit institutions in the world. Later this year, we are hosting the International Congress on Auditors General. 174 Auditors General will be coming to South Africa. We're very proud that Mr. Mbembe will be the president of INCUSAI for the next 3 years, and he's not only giving leadership there within the country, but we believe in Africa and in the world in terms of accountability systems and good governance. And we've given you a copy of the Public Audit Act. We also believe that the Act is sufficiently stringent for us to give you audit of an international standard, with quality control processes that will provide you with reports that you can rely on, that we are putting in place well-qualified people that can produce these reports efficiently and in a manner that assists the public sector as well as yourselves to understand what the issues are that we raise. And if you know where the Auditor General was 10 years ago and where the Auditor General now is in terms of the skills that we have, Shalon is a chartered accountant, Justin is a chartered accountant, we are proud to, I don't know, do we know how many we have? But it's far more than probably 150. And I think that 10 years ago we were sitting with 3 chartered accountants. So really proud of that. We're the biggest training institution. We're bigger than Deloitte or PwC or KPMG or Ernst & Young in terms of training. We have trainee accountants, 800 at the moment, trainee accountants. It's a key focus area for us so that we can resource our office but also the public sector, because as much as we steal from you, the public sector also steals from the Auditor General. I think that the Public Audit Act provides that framework. It provides stringent accountability. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. So we also have to account. We get audited. We get scrutinized. There's a committee called the Standing Committee on the Auditor General that is supposed to oversee us, and they do so regularly. And we're very happy to keep our pencils sharp so that they can be confident that we are giving you a good audit service. But Chair, I don't think I want to go into too much more detail about that unless you do have questions about the Public Audit Act framework and some of the others.
Conference, you refer to international conference.
It's an international conference.
Yes. What is the program for Africa. I know we've got strong ties with Australia and Canada. We just referred this conference, but what's happening north of us?
A lot. Mr. Mbube is the current president of AfroSci. It's the African Organization of Supreme Order Institutions. And there are numerous programs that have been running for, must be more than 9 years now, training programs. South Africa is also the secretariat. And I think if you'd like, we can give you some more information, but there are a lot. In fact, there was a World Bank-sponsored conference last week, that short week that I was on leave, was it the 6th, 7th, and 8th of April, where Auditors General of 14 of the countries came through and they had a workshop about transparency and accountability. So I think although we interact with the so-called First World Audit Officers, our passion certainly lies with the continent, and there are extensive programs. And I think that the transfer of knowledge and what we have learned as we engage with a bigger fraternity of Auditors General is feeding back into the continent in a very focused manner.
Chani is the chairperson of the Select Committee on Appropriations. And what we are looking at is that Committee on Appropriations jointly with, say, the Select Committee on Agriculture or Health or what, Police, sit together when we deal with budgets of the different departments, but also with the annual report at the end of the year. Now, in the past, this committee wasn't part of the APAC training sessions. I went back into the history of the NCP. And I think we must change it, because the AG is a role player for this committee as well. That's why we're having this workshop. Going to your words of training, that we become part of the training program of APAC for the future. I just want to make that remark. The other one is to get a monitoring tool, or to develop a monitoring tool when you deal with a department. Now, I have the advantage, and I was fortunate to be part of developing such a monitoring tool for safety and security in the legislature in the Northern Cape. The other pilot provinces, Free State in the Northwest, which I think was a good document to assist committees, especially safety and security then, our police, to do their oversight. And that will assist members in the different committees, because most of the members might be new, as a guide, a handbook, for the people who comes after us.
Thank you, Chair, and from our side, Chair of the Appropriations Committee, will be most welcome. And I think we would certainly look forward to a continued relationship with both your committees. The Auditor General is here to serve Parliament, not SCOPA. SCOPA has traditionally been, not SCOPA only, SCOPA has traditionally been the committee where our reports are referred to in terms of Rule 108. Or 208, but you know, there's a rule that refers all our reports to SCOPA, which certainly makes them an important processing mechanism of our reports. But our commitment is to the whole of Parliament, and we are looking forward to our general reports, especially, Jay, becoming a very useful tool to you now. Without preempting what we will be discussing tomorrow, there are three general reports produced, national, provincial consolidated, and local government municipal. And we believe the last two are more appropriately focused on your needs and your mandate than perhaps the National Assembly. And we would certainly hope you to be taking those and engaging us on that regularly and robustly.
I think we need to congratulate November for going to be the president of that particular institution.
and we hope that you'll provide him with the necessary uniform that you'll wear as a general when he's presiding over there, like Mama Gaddafi.
In fact, we certainly will. Sharon Adams is very welcome. Thanks for coming through, Sharon. She's based in the Western Cape Audit Office. We have regional audit units, business units, and that's right. And she also has the dubious honor of being the Auditor of Parliament, as we said, but I don't think we want to discuss that today. But if we could ask Sharon just to share with you some of the fundamental elements of internal control, because, you know, when we speak financial management, we're not all on the same level of understanding necessarily. I think that if you engage these topics and these annual reports and some of the terms that are used, if Sharon can share some of those basic elements with you, I think it would make your life a little easier. So you're very welcome, Sharon. I think if you're more comfortable with doing the slide. Yes.
Good morning to the members and the chairperson of the committee. Just to indicate, my roots is from the Eastern Cape, so I'm originally from the Eastern Cape. Came to study at Cape Town, and then worked at Ernst & Young, did my articles there. Also joined at Sibley & Saluba in the Forensic Audit Division, worked there for about 3 years, after which I joined the Office of the Auditor General, and I've been with the office for about 6 years. So this morning it's really an honor and a privilege for me to be able to do this presentation, and I hope I will do the presentation on the level that will be understandable by the members. We will allow for questions after the presentation. The next slide, I think the members are quite familiar with, because in terms of our reputational promise as the Auditor General, in the constitutional mandate. But what I would like to add in this particular slide is just in terms of our focus area of the Auditor General. The Auditor General is very clear in terms of our constitutional mandate. When we communicate audit reports, it needs to be clear, simple, and understandable for any person in the public to use those audit reports. And the second focus area, based on our mandate that we've got, that the Auditor General wants us to focus on, is leadership visibility. As leadership of our organization, at our audit points, we need to be visible all the time and throughout the year, and not have a situation where we audit basically and move out of the organization, and in a year's time we come back, and on a continuous basis you find that the findings that you've raised is raised again. But from the Auditor General side, his drive is for this next year is for us to be visible and on a continuous basis to have monitoring controls in place at our different places that we do audit. Now, this is just a quote from our president relating to internal control, and this recognition is there is a weak financial management, which often result in irregular expenditure, corruption, and adverse audit outcomes by the Auditor General. And that's what was basically said by our president last year. So there's acknowledgement that in terms of financial management and a good internal control system, that has a direct correlation in terms of the impact and the outcome of the audit report. And I think this morning's session is specifically relating to when members receive those audit reports, what is actually said in those audit reports, when the Auditor General gives an opinion on that audit report, and what is the crux of the matter as member of the Finance Committee. The members need to focus on to go to those areas to see what is the actual problem with that institution while that institution received either a disclaimer, adverse, or qualified audit report. And hopefully, based on the discussion that we will have now, we will be able to go to those root cause areas that result in those adverse audit reports. Internal control, I think during the past few years there has been all this focus about internal control and why this whole fuss about internal control. And as Parliament, we deal with the public funds. It's not our own money. It's the public funds, and there's certain oversight roles that need to be played in terms of management of those funds. And I think that's where the fuss about the whole internal control environment comes from. And the perception, sometimes the perception is that if there's an effective internal control environment, there wouldn't be fraud in an organization, and I think that's an incorrect perception. There could be good foundation of internal control, but fraud could still occur within the organization. And by preventing that fraud, it's about the monitoring control that occurs also on a continuous basis and reinforcement by management at the end of the day. The next question was probably that I asked myself, what do we mean by internal control? What is internal control? Is it more about just checking and balancing, checking that somebody did his work and that the accounts balance, the balance sheet balance? Normally, I don't know who of the members did accounting at school. That balance sheet never used to balance, but it's about checking balances, making sure that the balancing does occur. Or is it a response to restricting the objectives of an organization? As any department, any municipality, they've got certain key objectives based on what the outcomes was that the president indicates in his speech, and based on those outcomes, certain objectives must be met at the end of the day. So what do we mean by internal control? And basically, when we just go to eye level to why an organization needs internal control and where this whole issue of internal control comes from, it basically just generally comes from the COSA framework. As you all know, in the past there has been a lot of fraud that has occurred in certain companies, and this basically came about the whole fraud incident that occurred at Enron, and where the members basically, as a committee, sat together and say, we need to strengthen the internal control environment, or these are the key elements that need to be present for an organization to function effectively. So an organization needs internal control to provide greater assurance that they will achieve their operating, financial reporting, and compliance objectives. So that is the crux of internal control. As an organization, will I be able to receive to report on my operating, financial reporting, and compliance objectives. Furthermore, internal control helps to ensure that direction, policies, procedures, and practices are designed. First of all, it needs to be designed and then approved by management to put in place the functioning and desired outcomes. So, very important, there needs to be certain policies and procedures that will govern the control environment, because without policies and procedures, everybody will just follow their own method of doing certain things. So it's very important. Now, just in terms of the focus area of the Auditor General's report, when you receive an audit report from the Auditor General in front of you, the audit report, when we give an opinion on in the financial statements, there's three areas that we focus on. The first area that we focus on, we first indicate, does the financial statement fairly present in all material respects? And if the answer is yes, meaning there is sound financial management at the organization and the report is basically unqualified. The second focus area at the Auditor General that we have, we also look at compliance to laws and regulations. As in terms of the public sector, we are very driven by compliance to laws and regulations. And so when there's material non-compliance to laws and regulations, we also report on those non-compliance. The third area that we also focus on is in terms of our performance information, in terms of our strategic goals and objectives at the department, that we fulfill those strategic goals and objectives and that we report on those targets and outcomes in the annual report. So we also give, um, we do for this year, we're not going to give an opinion on performance information, but we just do a review of performance information. But in our management letter for this financial year, there will be an opinion on performance information to indicate what is the state of performance information within that department. In terms of when you basically receive an audit report, and that audit report is either a disclaimer of audit opinion, or an adverse audit opinion, or qualified audit opinion. One of the paragraphs that's included in the audit report relates to the internal control environment. And as part of the audit report, we normally would include to indicate, in terms of the internal control environment, why did this qualification occur? And we will, as the Auditor General, indicate what is the root cause, what went wrong in the department, in the institution, for that qualified audit opinion that occurred. And in that paragraph, we will basically indicate, was it a leadership problem, was it a financial management issue, or is it a governance issue? And we will highlight that as part of the audit report. Now, in terms of when we speak about leadership, we basically look in terms of the control environment, what is the tone at the top? Does management create a favorable environment for good financial management and service delivery? And basically, an example I can give you or other issues in terms of what the tone at the top is. If fraud occurs, how does management react to fraud that occurs? Is it a case where management just accepts fraud, or is it a case where management is going to make a statement and take corrective action against those employees that has done the fraud? So when we look at this, we also look at what are the ethical environment. Is there a code of conduct in place at the institution? So the tone at the top is very important. What tone does the leadership set at the top? How does leadership basically feel about the daily running of the business and in terms of the control environment of the business? So when you basically get the Auditor General, either in the general report or in the audit report, when you look at the internal control paragraph, these things will be highlighted to indicate there is an issue with leadership, there is an issue at the tone at the top, and that is the crux of why things went wrong in a department organization. Secondly, we look at the identification of key control aims to achieve clean audit reports. And by clean audit reports, we only don't mean that there must be an unqualified audit report, but as in the past 5 years, the Auditor General also report on governance matters. And those governance matters basically relate to, in terms of the internal controlled environment, if there's certain deficiencies relating to the role of the internal audit and the audit committee has to play, how the organization function in terms of risk management, how serious they take risk management at the end of the day. And then lastly, we also look at the IT controls in place at the organization. So what we're basically saying, for somebody to achieve a clean audit report, they must also have no other matters in their audit report. And I think at the later stage, Justin will take the members through the process of the audit process, and that will provide more detail to the members of how the audit process work and how the audit process functions. And just to clarify, when we speak about clean audit reports, it doesn't just mean unqualified, but it also means there's no other matters included in the audit report relating to the governance framework or to performance information. So that is what we mean by clean audit report. And I think the Minister has indicated by 2014 he wants clean audit report, so that is what we're working towards. The third issue, when we look at leadership, we assess the skills, competency of the finance staff. And what's important for us here, you must just not have people appointed in that position, but you must have the right people for the right job. Because there is instances that people are appointed, but in terms of they're not the right people for the right job. And then as a result of that, certain laggings occur within the internal control environment. So when we speak about leadership and refer to certain issues, we will also indicate in terms of the skills and competency of the finance staff specifically appointed. We won't indicate they're incompetent, but we'll just talk about it. And ensuring the right staffing, because in some instances, there could be cases where consultants is needed, that the expertise are not internally. But what we found in terms based on our interaction, consultants are appointments, but those transfer of skills never take place. So you find within an organization on a year-to-year basis, they appoint the same consultant and their skills transfer doesn't take place, which at the end of the day does cost more money for the department or the institution at the end of the day. So when we're looking at that, we also look at the role of the consultants, what role do they play, and is that adequate skills transfer taking place, or are the department too much reliant on that consultant at the end of the day, that they cannot function without the consultants, which will be a concerning issue for us to raise. The second issue that we focus on when we look at the internal control environment, and the Auditor General has been driving to indicate there needs to be monthly production of financial statements. Because what we find mostly in most of the institution department at year end, they put all these efforts in to prepare the financial statement, and then normally 2 months is basically lost because they are preparing the financial statements. And what the Auditor General is basically driving, and if you look at the system of internal control, if there is daily transaction that occurs on a daily basis, recording of transaction takes place on a daily basis, and monthly reconciliations are performed, that at the end of the day will assist you to do monthly financial statements of financial and non-financial information on a continuous basis in monitoring. One of the challenges that we had over the past few years, because performance information is something new that the Auditor General is looking at, that in terms of providing that information and having that information readily available and the supporting that information where it comes from, we do have current challenges with that. So what we are saying, if monthly financial statements are produced and non-financial information is produced on a monthly basis, when you come to do your audit, you shouldn't have any problems because those records are kept on a monthly basis, because a lot of the instances, for example, where the control is not functioning, so at year end, there's more work that needs to be done, more reconciliation, more checking that needs to be done because of that daily transaction that's not occurring on a daily basis. The second issue is in terms of the sound financial management system and documentation control procedures needs to be institutionalized. And here specifically, we're talking about policies and procedures in terms of an institution. And what we found in a lot of institutions, there is policies and procedures, but a lot of cases there's no procedure manual. If I'm a new person coming into the organization, there should be a procedure manual to say, if I'm the debtor's clerk, this is what is expected of me to be done. And in terms of that sound financial management, we do find challenges that, for example, because I don't know what I'm responsible to do. If I'm the filing clerk, I'm supposed to make sure that those documents are filed safely and it's safeguarded. So when the auditors come, then documentations are not missing. So each person within the organization should understand what their role and responsibility is, and it needs to be institutionalized and not dependent. If something happened to the finance officer, then the whole organization fell flat. So that's why important we say, we talk about policies and procedures need to be institutionalized, so any person that will come will be able to know how this organization is functioning and be able to take over from another person. The third issue is basically operating basic internal control for efficient financial management and the environment. This issue is relating to create the right environment for that control to function. And what it indicates here is basically those monitoring controls. You can have that in issues that you transact on a daily basis, but certain reviewing also needs to be done at the right level and on a continuous basis. So those are just in terms of financial management, what the focus areas that we basically focus on when we look at the internal control environment. In terms of governance, as part of our audit report, we also report on other matters, and that specifically relates to the governance processes within an institution. And what we found that in terms of the governance framework, what is important, the role of internal audit has to play and the role of the audit committee at the end of the day. And in terms of one of our challenges that we find with a lot of organizations, the internal audit unit is not sourced properly. They don't have people with the proper skills, and they don't capacitate the internal audit unit. And in most of the cases, in organizations where those units are capacitated and they've got the proper skills, you'll find that the internal audit unit is basically responsible to make sure those controls that management has implemented over the years, did those controls function properly? And the internal audit normally reports to management to say, this control that we've implemented, say for example, if bank reconciliations need to be signed on a monthly basis, it's not done. So the internal audit unit is basically an early warning sign before the external auditor comes in to pick up those control matters. But because the internal audit units in most cases are not capacitated, they don't get the proper support at the end of the day to be able to do the assurance role in terms of Section 38 of the PFMA, which links back to what the role of the accounting officer is at the end of the day. You find that only when the external auditors come, these control weaknesses are then picked up and then communicated to management, and sometimes it's at a very late stage of the audit, and then there's not enough time for management to do corrective actions to make those adjustments to the financial statements, because that misstatement could be so big and could be take quite a while to make those corrections, where if internal audit unit in terms of their role could be able to play the role to warn management upfront, then at the end of the day the audit outcome could have been different in terms of the oversight role. And I think the second issue in terms of the role of the accounting officer, I don't know if this will link back to the prison, to the section. Oh, yeah. And I think all the members are most probably familiar with the role of the accounting officer. But I think the other thing that I just wanted to highlight in terms of Section 38 is the role of the accounting officer relating to the risk management process. Because the main focus when we actually look at the internal control environment, I think just the first one, effective and efficient and transparent system of financial and risk management and internal control. And that is one of the functions of the accounting officers and one of his responsibilities. And I think what's important in terms of risk management and the tone at the top, that those risks is identified. What we found a lot when risk identification takes place within an organization, they basically focus majority on operational risk. And I think our drive has been in terms of when we had debrief meetings with our departments and with the municipalities after we've issued our audit reports, we've indicated to them as part of your risk management process, you should have a risk relating to the financial statements being misstated and also a risk relating to performance management, so that those risks are monitored on a monthly basis and internal audit at the end of the day basically go do that testing to make sure that those risks are addressed from an audit point of view in terms of their role. And I think the other issue that we would like to highlight, what the role of the audit committee and what important oversight role the audit committee has to play in terms of governance and in terms of their oversight function. At the end of the day, the audit committee's main responsibility is to report to the organization in terms of was the controlling environment effective throughout the year, and they need to report on that. And the other issue they also need to report in terms of the internal controls relating to the organization, was there sound internal controls. And the only way they can do that is by getting feedback from the internal audit unit that will be able to perform that function. But if the internal audit unit are not functioning effectively, the audit committee won't be able to play that oversight function. What a lot of people have linked to the audit committee is the risk management function, and also in terms of the fraud cases that's reported, indicating that there is follow-up of these cases at the end of the day of the fraud cases. So in terms of governance, it's the maintenance of effective risk management strategy including a fraud prevention plan. And in terms of our focus, we focus a lot on was the risk management adequately for the year, and we do an evaluation of the risk management process. Is that continuous feedback on the risk of the organization, and is it monitored by management on a frequent basis? And also in terms of fraud prevention plan, in terms of the whistleblowing policy, we also evaluate was there a fraud prevention plan, and was the management effectively communicate this to the staff members, and was the right tone set at the top at the end of the day? I don't know if the members got any questions.
It's 10 minutes past 12, and we agreed that we will return at 25 minutes past 12 to go to the radio service. So there's now 10 minutes. Because I see on the program, Mr. Boetes, Justin will take us through his presentation before lunch.
After lunch. 2
after
o'clock.
Lunch. Over two. All right. Time for questions. Just 1 point. Parliament deals with quarterly reports, different committees in the NA, but also in select committees in the NCOP, and it will be of assistance if, and again, we look at the ideal situation, is with a quarterly report, you get a quarterly audit report to pick up the issues before you come to the annual report at the end of the year. And that's where those audit committees come in. And we'll have to work towards that.
100%.
We'll have to work towards that.
I think one of the drives from the Auditor General is that I mentioned in terms of visibility that we need to be visible throughout the year. And one of the things that we are doing now at municipal level and at department, when we basically done it with the audit, is still to visit those sites on a quarterly basis and to go into, in terms of their action plan, because each municipality department has to prepare an action plan indicating if there's findings raised by the Auditor General, how, what corrective action they should take that. So we basically monitor those action plans on a continuous basis, and also in terms of the systems of internal control, we basically will go out now and basically assess, are those key controls functioning, those key controls that we've reported on that's not functioning. When we go back there, like an interim assessment, are those key controls functioning, so that we don't come too late at the end and then there's not enough sufficient time to take corrective action. I think in terms of that, the internal audit reports are quite in detail, but I think what the committee can request is for the chairperson of the audit committee to communicate to the committee when there are key elements that will have an impact on the audit results, to communicate those items to the committee from the chairperson of the audit committee.
For 6 years in the Northern Cape, the Department of Health received a disclaimer. And that is one of the issues. We dealt with a quarterly report, but there could have been a quarterly audit as well. We could have picked up the problems.
Yes, yes.
But they're not busy with their turnaround strategy after 7 years.
Ideal.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I just wanted to check actually an operational thing, whether, because I'm understanding that you are on the front line of actually doing the auditing, whether you have picked up some relationship between adverse opinion in relation to lack of documentation or source documents with audits that are done by consultants in all these other municipalities and other institutions, whether you have picked up any relationship.
Just in terms of when it's specifically done by consultants, if what the audit outcome was the audit outcome different? What I can just basically talk on based on my experience in those institutions that I've been involved in. In the case where they have appointed consultants, and what we must remember also with the municipalities, they basically had to move from the info basis of accounting to modified to graph basis of accounting. So from a technical point of view, there was a lot of work that was required from consultants. And as a result of sometimes those consultants' involvement, the audit outcome changed as a result of that. So in a way, there was like a correlation between when they appointed consultants to assist them with the financial statements, that basically as an impact on the audit outcome from a technical point of view. But also what I found in a lot of instances where an institution didn't receive a qualified audit report, either adverse or disclaimer qualified audit report, but that institution had governance issues. It was as a result of daily transactions not occurring throughout the year, as a result of reconciliations not being performed on a monthly basis. And the other issues I think that we've just identified within the Western Cape is also they don't have a checklist to say, this is now the finance, you know, this is my month end now. These are the documents that I'm requiring to have for month end, and these are supposed to be prepared for month end. So in a way, there was instances where there's a correlation between when there was consultant, the outcome was different, and also the inverse effect, depending on who the consultants were.
Thank you. I'm trying to put a question to you now. Perhaps I hope you can answer my question. You just said that some of the municipalities, some departments, they use consultants to assist them with a financial statement. Then the question comes, what is the purpose of the CFO?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we were indicating, and I think one of the things are appointing the people for the right job, and what we must also remember in terms of the history of the municipalities and also the department, a lot of the CFOs currently there that was appointed years ago in terms of their skills and competencies, so their accounting focus was on info. So now this is something new, so that's why we're indicating when those consultants are appointed, there needs to be transfer skill, but the need for the consultants to be there isn't it because of the technical nature of those issues. I can just maybe name an example. For example, on fixed assets in terms of measurement, the measurements of the roads, the measurements of that infrastructure assets, it's very technical, and it's not any person that will be able to do that. So from that point of view, there is a need for consultants, but I think what we need to be cautious of, if consultants is used, it's not on a continuous basis, and that skills transfer takes place. It's not a case that the CFO is there, but for every year, for 5 years, those consultants, yes, in year 1 to 3 is there, but going forward, there should be those skills transfers and training needs to be provided to the CFO to be able to upskill himself to get on that level.
All right, don't we think that the just at the initial beginning of any person in any office, then we go what do you call the induction, proper induction, not showing of the toilet and what, but we go, or we tell that person what we call man tot man on the roof. You just take him man to man instruction. He said, this is at the end of the month, you do 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, I think the main focus, and I think it also comes in our general report, is in terms of training that occurs at the end of the day with those key role players. But I think what's important to note is in what is the tone set at the top of leadership? Is leadership, are they focused on training and upskilling the individuals to be able to reach that competence? Is there a training program in place to get the staff members on that level? And I think the basic thing for me, what I've picked up in terms of my experience, is basic job descriptions in some cases are not in place. So if I'm the data clerk, I don't know what I'm doing. If I'm the creditor, I don't know. So I think going back to the basic, what is the basic thing that needs to be there will make a huge difference in terms of the outcomes, and vice versa, also in taking to the technical aspect. The technical aspect can also be fixed. But if there's daily record keeping and daily transaction, I think that is what we're trying to emphasize. If that daily recording of transactions doesn't occur, then coming audit time, we will have a problem, because either if that daily transaction didn't occur, the documentations could go missing, and there's indicators for fraud that can occur. Because, for example, if that daily transaction can occur and there's monitoring by management, immediately when something is not right on the system, red flag should be raised, exception reports should be printed and monitored. But because of that not occurring, then those things cannot be picked up during the year. Then only when the auditors come, then those things are picked up. So that should be the key focus areas.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for all of the information. Honourable members, we will now adjourn and reconvene at 2 o'clock and join the memorial service in the Old Assembly Chapel.
Thank you.
That the AGSA delivers in terms of the mandate that was explained earlier, what those products are, and in essence where we're moving toward with regard to refining some of the products that we offer and enhancing some of those products to basically change the direction in which we audit and the focus that we put on audit. So allow me to go through the process. If there are any questions during the presentation, you're welcome to stop me. If not, then we'll take questions at the end of the presentation. Also, members, in the interest of time, I may not be covering the full presentation because it's really split into two parts. The first part is what it is we do and what products we offer. And then the second part, which is quite in detail, talks about the audit process, so what we do during an audit process. So I may not be able to cover that second part, but I think the important part is what products do we deliver with regard to our mandate. I think the reputation, promise, stroke, mission of the AGSA has been, you have been taken through the reputation promise and what it means. So I'll skip that slide. Then just very briefly, the benefits of an external audit. With regard to the our current mandate, which is to express an audit opinion on financial statements, in doing that, it adds credibility to the information provided by all our auditees, our departments, national departments, provincial departments. In doing and in performing our audit process and ultimately reporting, we assist in strengthening of the oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector, which is something that is enshrined in our mission stroke vision. We also assist in giving momentum to the process of transformation, particularly with regard to financial management within the public sector. We know that in the public sector, through our various audit products and reports, we report on, in essence, the state of financial management in the public sector for each entity. And so when we do deliberate in the audit report around our audit findings, we add emphasis to the state of financial management within the public sector. And then also to provide decision makers with the ability with insights so that they can plan and make strategic decisions around how to improve financial management in the public sector. That's making a difference in the lives of all our South African citizens. With regard to the different types of audit, There are mandatory audits that we perform. The first one is a regularity audit, and in essence, the financial audit, which provides comfort that the financial information is fairly presented and reflected in the financial statements, and then also enables proper oversight. Once you know that that information is credible, then you're able to discern over the details. It's required in terms of the Public Audit Act. In essence, it gives an opinion on whether the financial statements and the numbers therein are fairly presented. And I know that in the previous discussions and presentations, it was elaborated on what exactly that means to the public and what that means to the decision makers. Also, in that regularity report linked to financial management, we do reflect on, ultimately reflecting on the financial management status of any entity, we consider the internal control environment of any entity. And in considering the internal control environment, we come to a conclusion around financial management in the public sector. We also look at, in terms of the requirements, the legislative requirements to have governance frameworks in place. We look at the compliance with those requirements in terms of the legislation as it relates to internal audit committee and other legislative compliance. But we also evaluate the effective work, I think, of the internal audit and audit committee functions, those governance structures. Do they have the ability and have they influenced the financial management status of an entity positively? Or were they ineffective in assisting management of the department in fulfilling their responsibilities as it relates to financial management? So we do make that type of analysis in the audit report as well as the management report. We also look at certain value for money themes that we've decided as an organization countrywide that would be considered in all, for example, all health departments, where we identify a theme and we execute that theme at all provincial departments within all provincial health departments in the country. The ultimate objective there is to express a view with regard to that particular identified transversal area for the country as a whole. And that view is normally expressed or reported in a general report for the country. Now, one of those themes in the health sector that we've identified for execution for this year is the HIV and AIDS program and how those programs are rolled out in each of the provincial departments. In the other sectors, we're looking at the housing sector and the delivery process with regard to providing housing. We're also looking at the education sector as well as the transport and works or the work sector across the country. And those reflections, as I indicated, will then be presented in the general report, consolidated general report reflecting those transversal matters for the country as a whole. But that regularity audit also includes an element of evaluating compliance with key pieces of legislation, in particular, the Public Finance and Management Act, with our municipal audit, the Municipal Finance and Management Act, also key enabling legislation, which brings about the establishment of certain of our entities. And so we do look at whether those entities have complied with those key pieces of legislation, and then the impact of non-compliance with regard to financial management and other processes. The other type of audit, which I've mentioned, is the audit of performance information. Now, this is a fairly new discipline within our organization that we've been focusing on for the last, well, since 2004, 2005. And it's a considered approach that the Auditor General took in ultimately issuing an audit opinion on performance information possibly in 2011, 2012. That assessment and how we got to that date of finally reporting in terms of an audit opinion on performance information was considered after evaluating the readiness of our public sector to have an audit opinion expressed on performance information. Now, performance information, as you know, is related directly to service delivery objectives and what has been set up front by certain of our entities to be their performance outcomes at the end of the year. And our role in evaluating and auditing the performance information is determining whether what has been reported in the annual reports are credible information or is credible information, so that the decision makers and management can take a set of creditworthy information and really probe as to why targets were not met, were the targets that were set reasonable, and ultimately then bring to account where delivery has not occurred in accordance with the stated objectives as per the strategic plans and the audit, the annual audit plans of entities. The other discipline within the our ambit of product is the performance auditing. And at the beginning I mentioned that there are two areas that we're looking to enhance and refine in terms of our processes and spend more effort on and emphasize more. This is the second one, performance auditing. Performance information is the first area. And performance auditing, including environmental auditing, is looking at whether services and resources were procured economically, utilized efficiently and effectively. And I'll give you an example of what it is we look for. If you consider a rural area like the Eastern Cape, and you consider that a department in terms of performing its functions needs to go out to rural areas and inspect, for example, clinics, they may procure vehicles, and it may be economic in terms of procuring a VW Chico as an example. But whether it will be effective to use a VW Chico to drive to a rural area in the Eastern Cape, we need to consider that. So when looking at a performance type of audit, you will look at whether, yes, it is economic to purchase a VW Chico, but does it meet the need of driving to a rural area and getting to inspect clinics? Will the Chico break in the first month or not? Isn't it better to consider a 4x4, even though it may not be economic, but it will result in efficient and effective utilization of that resource, which will lead to service delivery. So that's the type of emphasis that is placed and considered during the audit of during a performance audit. We don't evaluate the policy as such that has been established by the entity, by the cabinet, by various legislatures, but we do comment on the impact of that policy as it relates to whether resources are procured economically and utilized effectively and efficiently. Then also a new discipline that we've established recently in the ambit of products that we deliver is looking at special investigations, or investigations as we call it. In terms of the Public Audit Act Section 5, the AG can consider the performance of a discretionary audit or an investigation if it is in the interest of the public to perform such an evaluation or investigation. And the one that springs to mind and recently conducted and concluded was the special investigation into the SABC affairs. That's the type of audit that is not within the norm and the realm of a regularity audit, which seeks to express an audit opinion on financial statements, but goes a bit further in looking at matters that are in the interest of the public. Those audits, and including the special audits, as I said, are areas that we are looking at enhancing and providing more or placing more emphasis on and resourcing ourselves appropriately to perform those functions. At the moment, about 85 to 90% of our resources are spent on on performing regularity audits. The other 10% is spent on special audits, on special investigations, on performance auditing, and those discretionary audits. So we're looking at reversing that trend in time to come, and in time to come is a period of 5 to 10 years, because one cannot reverse that ratio if we still have financial management concerns, basic financial management concerns in the public sector. Once we get to a level where the financial management capability of public sectors improves to a level that we need to spend less time on regularity audit, the pendulum will swing and we then are able to utilize our resources more on discretionary audits as opposed to the basic regularity audits. I think then also to in terms of the audit process, in order for us to render those opinions, to perform the work that we do, our independence is key to the process. And as the heading indicates, independence equals credibility. And so when we conduct an audit, the staff of the Auditor General needs to appear to be free and independent and objective, and they need to, in actual fact, be independent and objective, so that the assurance that we provide is credible at the end of the day. All these audits that we are referring to are after the fact, post facto. However, discretionary audits can occur within phases once management has determined and made decisions that can be considered. We are, in terms of the Public Audit Act, prevented from performing any work that may impair that independence and subsequently we have to be audited by ourselves. So we cannot look at something that we would evaluate at a later stage in terms of the regularity audit or any other audit, any other discretionary audit. This depiction represents the difference between performance information and performance auditing. Now, in terms of what I've said, it just presents graphically the difference between the two. And if you go to the top of the depiction, there's a line in the middle that distinguishes performance information, which is mandatory, from performance audit, which is discretionary. On top, in terms of the reporting framework for performance information, that is set by specialists, including National Treasury and the Stats SA and the Public Service Commission. And they set those stats both for norms, national indicators, norms and practices. Cabinet and legislatures in across the provinces develop the policy, the strategic planning, the budget, and the oversight. And then the executive authority in the provincial setup, in the MECs, are responsible for the implementation, monitoring, corrective action, and reporting on performance information, both on performance information.
Yeah, I feel that I must ask this question because I'm stuck with this page, but you're already on the next page because I'm failing to understand. Now, I want to be part of you. On page 10, that last statement, I think you left me there when you started the next page because I'm still trying to understand what this statement seeks to say. Does it mean that the Auditor General's work or operations are not audited? What does it mean? This statement, what does it mean? Because I've got a feeling that even the manner in which you're running that the Auditor General's office surely needs to be audited for some extent. Somebody has to tell people that you are doing things all right and you are performing on the financial expenditure of doing your own work. But this statement then puts me on a crossroads. Thanks.
Thank you, Member. The Auditor General, as a statutory or as a constitutional institution, Chapter 9 institution, sorry, is subject to external audit as well as internal audit, like any other statutory institution or auditee that we audit. So in other words, the financial statements, we need to produce financial statements on an annual basis. We need to produce performance information on an annual basis. That needs to be audited by an external audit firm, and the results of which are contained in an annual report which gets oversighted by the Standing Committee on the Auditor General. We also have our own governance arrangements with relation to internal audit functions as well as audit committee functions. So the best practice that is expected of our auditees, our departments, our public entities, the same good practices and best practices are incumbent on the AGSA to conform to, and there are those structures that do oversight over the Auditor General, such as the Standing Committee on the Auditor General. This last bullet refers to when we perform a regularity audit, we in essence evaluate management's compliance with accounting frameworks as well as their strategic plan and their annual performance plans. In considering a discretionary audit, we cannot discern over a discretionary audit where the scope may indicate that we have to perform a management function. So, for example, if management requests us to do a special audit beyond the scope of a regularity audit, and the scope of that special audit indicates that we must determine what the credibility of the debtor's book, which in essence is a management function. If we do that, then at a later stage, when we come back to do the regularity audit, we will have to look at our own work again in forming a conclusion on the opinion on financial statements. So this statement is saying we cannot perform any work that we subsequently will have to express an audit opinion on. And in essence, that relates to a management function. We can't do management function for them in terms of a special audit. The difference between performance information and performance auditing, if we go to the external audit row, as we indicated, on the performance information, the objective is to review, confirm the validity, accuracy and completeness of the performance information that is reported in the annual report. And that completeness talks to, and validity talks to, what has been reported in the annual report is exactly what the department had set itself to do in its annual plan and its strategic plan. So there needs to be alignment from the strategic plan, the annual plan, into the ultimate reporting document being the annual report. And that we check for completeness of information carried through in the process, as well as what I indicated earlier was whether the numbers that are being reported, for example, if the entity had indicated they built 6 houses, as an example, that there is sufficient and appropriate audit evidence to demonstrate that 6 houses were in fact built and not 5 houses, which will then result in an audit opinion that may not be favorable. With regard to compliance, in terms of the regularity process, which is determined by various pieces of legislation, with regard to the municipal environment, it's the Municipal Structures Act, which imposes certain requirements on management when they do determine service delivery objectives. We also audit the compliance with those key pieces of legislation. and we report at an entity level as well as to the legislature on performance information as part of the regularity audit process. Now, at this stage, as we indicated earlier, the audit opinion on performance information is only, we will only express an audit opinion in the near future, a year or two's time, primarily because we found that the public sector is not at a state of readiness to have an audit opinion expressed on the performance information. What we have been doing over the last couple of years since 2004-2005 has been, we've been lifting the bar with the ultimate objective of expressing that audit opinion in the next 2 years. We've been lifting the bar in a phased-in approach. So for the 2009 financial year that we're busy auditing with regard to public finance and management act auditees, we will express an opinion, but we won't make that opinion public in an audit report. We will express that opinion to management so that they know when we do it, what needs to be remedied within the next year or two. So it won't be a public audit opinion that we express on performance information for this year, but going forward in the next 2 years, we will express that audit opinion. On the right, with regard to the external audit, the focus is on performance auditing discipline, and as we indicated, evaluating the efficiency, effectiveness, and economic procurement of a project or a program in terms of its objectives. It often requires expert analysis, qualitative analysis, and often done by subject matter experts. There, in terms of the reporting, we report at an entity level, and we may also report on a transversal level by segment or by cluster or across tiers of government and related public entities. So, for example, we could perform or execute a performance audit at the health departments across the country and report accordingly in a separate audit report and not linked to the regularity audit report. Okay. Then, very briefly, in terms of how we audit and what guides us through the process of auditing, we conform to the International Standards on Auditing, which we refer to as the ISAS, and that is used by the international auditing profession across the world, both private and public sector auditors. So there's very little distinction between a set of the audits that we perform versus the audits that are performed on an entity like Shell or Engen. We do have specific public sector perspectives added to the international standards on auditing, and those are based on international standards related to the supreme audit institutions of the world to which we belong. So those specific public sectors are brought to augment the difference between public sector and private sector. But as a baseline, we perform our audits in accordance with international standards on auditing, which are utilized and conformed to by the entire international auditing profession. With regard to performance auditing, we use our base as the international standards on auditing as well as the international standards on supreme audit institutions. For investigations, it's also based on international standards on auditing principles and our own standards and methodologies as documented. And then for special investigations or special audits, once again, also conforming to the international standards on auditing, with specific considerations of and decisions of complying with our own guidance and our own methodologies. Going forward, there is a move by the Auditor General to adopt and conform to the international standards for supreme audit institutions as opposed to the international standards on auditing, and that will make the audit process very akin and very specific to public sector auditing. But we are still considering that move within the next 2 to 3 years. Honourable Chair and members, the second part of the presentation, which talks about the audit process, and goes into detail about the audit process. I'm not sure if I should continue at this point in terms of time constraints, or would you want me to continue with this presentation, or take more questions on the types of audit and the products that the AGSA delivers. Ultimately, I'm guided by you, Chair. Thank you. With regard to the audit process, first, before we start an audit process, there are some engagement activities that we perform, and that talks to determining the right skill set and competencies of the audit team to perform the job. So we establish and evaluate whether we have the right people for the job. We also upfront determine and establish the terms of reference of the audit process with management. It's a very important process. It allows for us to be clear on what needs to be done and what our responsibilities are. Management understand what our responsibilities are, and it also allows for management to understand their responsibilities in the audit process, so that there is no so that there is clarity at the beginning. With regard to the planning process, one of the key and most fundamental parts of the audit process is the risk assessment process, because the risk assessment process drives, and the outcomes of the risk assessment drives the audit strategy and where we focus our audit attention. The audit process is a risk-based process, so we don't want to spend time on matters that are not assessed to be risky areas. So in that regard, we evaluate and engage on risk at two levels, at the level of the financial statements as a whole, and then also in detail with regard to the various components that make up those financial statements, the account balances and certain transactions. So we look at risk at those two levels, and we consider risk in determining the audit strategy. Things we look at during the audit process in identifying the risk and going through the risk assessment process is getting a complete understanding of what the entity does, the environment in which the entity operates, also understanding the accounting information and the control systems that have been implemented by management. Assessing the risk, and as I said, in two areas, looking at the focus areas both at financial statement level as well as the detailed component level of the financial statements. We consider what would be material for us to report and what would the user be interested in. And we set that number called materiality. So, for example, if we determine a number to be material of 10 rand and we find errors in the financial statements that are less than 10 rand, for example, 2 rand, then we won't find it necessary to report 2 rand in the context that 2 rand is not material to the users of the financial statements. And this is assuming that the materiality level that we set of 10 rand is in the context of an organization that spends hundreds of rands. However, matters of interest that would never have a materiality number attached to it is fraud perpetrated by potential fraud perpetrated by officials within any entity. There we don't attach a materiality number because qualitatively fraud and misappropriation is material from a qualitative point of view. So we don't attach a number to that, and we report on all instances of misappropriation and potential issues of fraud. So that materiality number is really determined by what would impact the users of those financial statements when they're making decisions based on the information contained in the financial statement. Developing an audit strategy, as I indicated, it is a risk-based strategy. However, the strategy also needs to determine and dictate that we as auditors reduce the risk that we express an inappropriate audit opinion. So that is why it's very, very important that we go through the process of understanding the entity, understanding the risks associated with the entity, the environment in which it operates, the internal control systems, so that we don't find ourselves wanting by indicating that a department or public entity is qualified when in actual fact it is not. And that's the risk that, that we try and reduce to zero in expressing an inappropriate audit opinion. With regard to the what I indicated previously was all around the planning process to develop the audit strategy. Then the next phase of the audit process is then the execution, the field work, where we execute our procedures based on the risk assessment. We don't perform 100% audit on all transactions and balances within an entity. We perform sample tests. Those sample tests, however, and the evidence that we collect on those samples needs to be sufficient and needs to be appropriate. In other words, it needs to be enough evidence or satisfactory amount of evidence and the right evidence that we need to gather during the audit process, because we're formulating an opinion on a sample of, let's say, transactions, and that opinion is expressed on the entire set of financial statements. So we only do a small portion in terms of a sample, but with the objective of expressing an opinion on the financial statement. So,
just make that very clear to me now. You're saying to us here that you don't do checks and honors to send you. Take, for example, a small one document on certain issues. I just want to put a question to you now like this. Just clear my mind. Department A, according to your document, has overspent 100 rand. And the department says, no, we've overspent 20 rand. Who must we believe now?
The question again.
The Auditor General report says they've overspent 100 rand. Based on what you've just said to me now, the department says they have overspent 40 rand, not 100 rand. Who must we believe now?
Remember, we certainly want to avoid that type of situation during the audit process, because the audit process caters for engagement at every level of a finding. And so at the end of the day, when we produce the report, it needs to be factual and it needs to be agreed up front with the respective management. Now, so in other words, that should not occur. Okay, it should not occur. If we do have a situation where it does occur, relating it back to the comment of 100% check versus a sample basis of check, the audit process that we engage with, which is quite a detailed audit process from the planning to the reporting, allows for us to be able to select a sample and have that sample be representative of the entire population of, let's say, expenditure. Because when we go through the process, we need to understand what impacts or what the root cause of that error in the sample is, and whether that error in the sample is pervasive to the entire population or not. Then we're in a position to say we are able to take that sample error and extrapolate it across the entire population, because the error that we found is a systemic error, as opposed to an isolated error. So we go through that process of analysis, we go through that process of evaluation based on our understanding of the business, based on our evaluation of the internal control environment, ultimately when we sit with the information and decide whether it can be extrapolated or not, we lean on and we consider the information that we've gathered throughout the audit process, which informs the final outcome. But so to say, we try and reduce to zero the disagreements between ourselves and management, because there is adequate time to engage on those through the audit process. And very importantly also, I think it touches on what the members indicated. When we formulate our audit opinion, we need to go through the process of gathering evidence. And that evidence comes from people or management of the entity. It comes from the paper that they, or the documentation that they produce. And so in essence, for lack of a better word, we can't thumbsuck information. It comes from the entities that we audit. It comes from discussions with officials. It comes from the documents that they produce. So it also strengthens adds to the credibility of the report at the end of the day. In terms of the audit documentation that we do collect, that audit documentation must also be able to stand on its own. It must be subject to any type of scrutiny. Audit documentation in terms of timelines are also important, because we find very often that we are unable to receive documentation in a timely manner from our auditees. And when we get to that point, I'll speak about the audit opinion that relates to that type of situation. And then a structured process needs to exist for requesting documentation from management within appropriate turnaround times. The final phase of the audit process is then the evaluation, conclusion, and reporting phase, where we consider all evidence obtained during the audit process. We report on all of our identified errors or exceptions, and as I indicated, either qualitatively or quantitatively in terms of rand value. And when we report, we relate or we correlate that quantitative rand value to that magical figure called materiality, where we determine what is material for the use of the financial statements to consider when they take strategic decisions around financial statements. Once again, qualitative factors, non-financial information like fraud perpetrated or misappropriation, that we will report even if it is 10 rand or 20 rand. It is a qualitative matter that we report on. The management report, all our audit findings are communicated to management via management report. Management respond to us in writing on the findings. The report includes both financial matters, a report on the financial matters in terms of the numbers, as well as an evaluation of the governance issues. Those governance issues, the example that we've used earlier is the effectiveness of the internal audit function as well as the audit committee function. At this stage, the management report is not a public document, or it never is a public document. However, anything that's material, either qualitatively or quantitatively, coming from the management report will then flow to the audit report. And the audit report is a public document. It is a reflection of the significant findings that come through and flow through from the management report. It is only public once tabled in the House or Parliament or the provincial legislature. Before that, it's not a public document, but it is used by various stakeholders and role players within the governance structures of a department to action certain remedial actions before it becomes public, where it's then discerned on by the Parliament or the provincial legislatures and the scopers. In terms of the mandatory audits, as I indicated, the mandatory audit reports that we issue are part of the annual reports of the entities that we audit. However, the discretionary audits, the performance audit, the special investigations and other special audits are not part of the annual report of the auditee, but form separate reports that which are tabled by the AGSA.
You have just said something that I just want to understand its practicality. You're saying the audit report will only become public after it has been tabled in the legislature or in parliament. Other than that, it won't. Now, what I want to check is there any possibility that an audit report of a particular department may be frustrated not to be tabled in the legislature? What would then be the situation? Or is it a thing that it's not possible for it to happen? That's what I just want to hear. Is the Auditor General have the responsibility of going and tabling? Or is it tabled on the wishes and the likings of other people? What's the situation?
On the same question, on the tabling when a document becomes public, coming to the, say for instance, to a municipal district or a local municipality, if that, where does the AG table it first, in the province or in the municipal level, so that we can know when must it be public then also? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, members. In terms of the Public Finance Management Act, as well as the Public Audit Act, there is a process that is required, that requires management to table the audit reports included in the annual reports. So the first requirement is then for the entity to produce an annual report, and included in that annual report must be the audit report. And there are set deadlines both for our PFMA auditees as well as our MFMA auditees, which prescribes the timelines within which those reports, annual reports, need to be tabled. So, for example, for our PFMA audits, the audit report or the annual report, sorry, must be presented to the MEC in the case of the provincial department or the minister, including the audit report within 1 month after the audit report is signed. Then that respective minister or MEC must table that annual report in the legislature within another month following that. So that's prescribed in the Public Finance Management Act and the Municipal Finance Management Act. Our responsibility with regard to our audit reports that are not tabled is contained in our Public Audit Act, which says Section 21, which indicates if an audit report is not tabled in the legislature within 1 month after the first sitting of that legislature, after the report has been submitted by the Auditor General must promptly publish the report. So then it becomes incumbent on us to publish the audit report. So we have had instances, and we monitor and we're mindful of, particularly in the municipal arena, where in certain instances the annual report is published without the audit report. And that's when we intervene in terms of the Public Audit Act to make the audit report public. So there is a process, there are timelines. With regard to the, I'm not sure if I addressed your question on the municipalities, member.
Let me just put it this way to you. A document, Auditor General's report, has been handed over to councillors, and the councillors will discuss it in the different parties at their caucuses. Is that document public now, or is it not public?
must chair through you. It must go through the same process of the count, the what's the head of the municipality? The executive mayor must table that in the council before it becomes a public document.
Well, it was tabled.
No, it shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. Okay. I think we can't overemphasize the importance of the audit communication or the communication during the audit process. Because the objective is to clarify the expectations, both of ourselves and of management, to ensure the process is smooth, and to prevent, in essence, surprises in the audit report. We don't want to be in a position where we indicate to the municipal manager or the head of the department on the 99th hour, just before we are about to sign, Mr. MM, you are going to be receiving a qualified audit report. In terms of the objective of us facilitating the achievement of clean audit reports in the public sector, we must be visible from a leadership point of view at all our auditees to pick up on red flags and danger signals and communicate that appropriately to management so that in the time that's available, they are able to make changes and prevent a negative audit outcome. And that has been to have that occur, our leadership needs to be visible during the audit process, and we've committed to ensuring that we are visible, and that in effect there are no surprises around the audit outcomes. We also in terms of the engagement letters and the engagement activities, we express those various responsibilities in those letters up front. We have structured meeting agendas and regular meetings with leadership of the institutions that we audit in the form of audit steering committee meetings. And then we also discuss our reports with the leadership of the entities that we audit, just to avoid, as the members indicated, a difference of opinion around the facts of the audit report. In terms of the format of the audit report, and this format has changed a bit from the prior audit reports that we've issued, the content hasn't changed. We've just shuffled a bit and placed different emphasis and more emphasis on certain matters. So what we've got in the audit report for the 19 financial year would be the report on the financial statements as such, and an audit opinion on whether the financial statements or the financial information is credible information. We're also highlighting this section any matters that we deem necessary to inform the public about. These are matters that are disclosed in the financial statements by the respective leadership of the entities. All we're doing is placing emphasis on it and bringing it to the attention of the users that there is something that the users need to note that has been adequately disclosed in the financial statements. The emphasis of matter does not impact on the audit opinion. It is not a qualification. It's just highlighting additional matters that has been adequately disclosed by management in the financial statements. The second section of the audit report deals with legal and other regulatory requirements. And here we report on predetermined objectives, which in other words, the performance information. We report on whether the entity has complied with the regulatory requirements of performance information or service delivery initiatives. We also report on compliance with laws and regulations. Primarily as we indicated, the PFMA, MFMA, and the key enabling legislation of our entities. When we consider the financial management of an entity, when we want to express ourselves in terms of whether the entity is financial, its financial management is mature, we evaluate the internal control environment of that entity. Now, it could be that you have an entity that received an unqualified audit opinion, but the internal control environment has room for improvement, and we reflect on those internal control, call it weaknesses, in three areas. And those three areas are key. They are leadership, financial and performance management units, and governance. Now, in the case of the internal controls, the Public Finance Management Act and the Municipal Finance Management Act imposes on leadership of the institution certain responsibilities. The accounting officer and the municipal manager has certain responsibilities flowing out from the pieces of legislation. We will evaluate whether those key pieces of legislation have been complied with in leadership performing their functions, their fiduciary and statutory functions accordingly. Any negative audit opinions will also be expressed and evaluated to determine the root cause in these three areas of leadership, financial and performance management, as well as governance. So we consider the key areas in terms of financial unit or the financial division of any entity, and we also consider the performance management unit in the case of performance information, whether those units did what they ought to have done in terms of their mandate and their responsibilities. As we indicated earlier, the governance arrangements and framework, primarily the internal audit function and the audit committee function, is also evaluated in terms of findings during the audit process and categorized into these three key areas. So whatever we report, whatever amount of detail we report that relates to internal controls will be categorized into these three key areas. I don't know if we need to take a pause on that, because that's a fundamental change in the manner in which we reported previously. Previously, we reported root causes. And those root causes needed to be collated and placed or strategically placed into these three key areas. Now we're going to report on these three key areas, bringing all those root causes and attaching them to either one or all of these three key areas. So in other words, you'll at a snapshot be able to see whether the internal control environment and its weaknesses are because leadership was not doing what they ought to have done, financial units within entities are doing or did not do what they should have done, or governance structures did not assist in improving the internal control environment.
Yeah, I still want to understand the first one. This is the fact, I think, this emphasis of matter highlights certain disclosures, not a qualification. If an audit opinion comes, it says unqualified, but then it talks with some emphasis of matter. And another opinion comes with unqualified, with no matters, are those two still the same? Its impact on the management, will that be the same? That's what I'm just wondering.
Through you, Chair. The emphasis of matter that we report, first of all, doesn't impact on the audit opinion. Right? And when we consider whether an entity has received, and we'll get to the detail a bit later and we'll elaborate on it, but when we consider whether an audit an entity has received a clean audit report, in other words, unqualified with no other matters, we don't consider emphasis of matter to be part of that evaluation. So if we say something, if we say an audit report is clean, then we mean there's no, there's an unqualified audit opinion, and there are no matters that relate to the second block or the second row. In other words, there are no issues on performance information as it relates to compliance with the regulatory framework. All the laws and regulations have been materially complied with. We have nothing to report on internal controls. In other words, leadership did what they were supposed to do. Financial management unit, financial units did what they were supposed to do. Governance structures did what they were supposed to do. Then we term it a clean audit opinion, and we ignore the emphasis of matter in getting to that conclusion. So the emphasis of matter is purely providing or highlighting to the user something which is already transparently disclosed by the accounting officer in the financial statements. If that makes, if that answers your question, member. The third section in the audit report, we make reference to other reports that were issued during the course of the financial year that we're auditing. Why it's important to mention the other report is when we do, if there are performance audits that have been completed while we during financial year, special audits and investigations, we need to consider the impact of those reports on the financial statements that we're expressing an audit opinion on. So if there's anything that comes out of those audits that impacts the numbers, impacts the issue of compliance with laws and regulation, impacts on internal controls, then we need to mention those reports in our audit report and consider the impact on the financial statements of the entity. So we make reference to other reports in that regard. It's also important for us to mention if there are no matters coming from those performance audits, special audits and investigations that impact on the financial statements. However, it may be important to mention that a department is has instituted X number of investigations into criminal conduct or misappropriation, and that the matter is still ongoing, which means that we wouldn't have had an opportunity to evaluate it for the financial statements that we're expressing an opinion on. So it's noteworthy to mention that type of information for the consideration of the use of the financial statements. And then, Chair and Honourable Members, the appreciation paragraph is a very sincere paragraph because the audit process is quite a lengthy and complex one. It's quite a difficult process, and so the appreciation paragraph that we express in the audit report is very sincere, where we thank management for their cooperation during the process and their timely response. We never have the need to remove that appreciation paragraph from the audit report. Member, I want sugarcoated. The audit process is a complex and difficult process. That's why we place a lot of emphasis on the communication during the audit process and the leadership visibility during the audit process, particularly from our side, particularly from the auditee side, so that we don't have a need to remove that appreciation paragraph. But we do have our moments, and ultimately I think at the end of the day the objective is achieved and both parties are reasonably satisfied with the outcome, and then that would necessitate the appreciation paragraph. Just to explain, and I think we've done it, but let's elaborate more on it, the different types of audit opinions that can be expressed. The unqualified audit opinion with no other matters is the ideal audit outcome. It's also referred to as a clean audit opinion, where financially the financial statements are credible, the information in the financial statements are credible, and there are no other matters that we need to report on. In other words, there are no non-compliance with laws and regulations, there are no issues with the performance information. There are no serious internal control weaknesses. Management and leadership have done what they ought to have done. Finance unit is operating effectively, as well as the governance structures. So that is an ideal situation. That is the drive by the Auditor General of South Africa to facilitate the achievement of clean audit reports in the public sector. And facilitating that ultimate outcome within our mandate and not transgressing the requirements to remain independent and objective of the audit process and of the audit tree that we audit. And the main, the most expedient manner in, and the most effective manner we think that can be achieved is having our leadership visible during audit processes and at all our auditees. The other audit opinion that we express is of unqualified audit opinion with other matters. Once again, there we could have, although the financial statements fairly present and the numbers are accurate, there are fundamental or foundational, should I say, weaknesses in the governance structures, the financial management of the entity, and those foundational cracks could at any stage, if not attended to, cause gaping holes which could very easily turn an entity from an unqualified audit opinion to a qualified audit opinion. And we find it necessary to highlight those other matters, those matters of concern to the foundation, i.e. compliance with laws and regulations, or non-compliance with laws and regulations, matters that relate to performance information and the regulatory environment, and those serious internal control weaknesses. We find it necessary to report those as other matters because if not attended to, auditees can very easily slip into the negative audit outcome or qualified audit opinion. Qualification, when we qualify or when we express a qualified audit opinion, we conclude that except for X, Y, and possibly Z, which signify material errors in the financial statements, the remainder of the financial statements reflect accurately or reflect fairly present. It is not a clean audit opinion. And it's not a desirable audit opinion because naturally if a qualification or qualified audit opinion could not have been prevented during an audit process, that means the foundation has cracked. That means those cracks that were there formed gaping holes and the matter could not be remedied or rectified during an audit process, which means it's foundational. And so it may be that the qualification is on one or two areas of the financial statements, but the fact that they're there, it is not a clean audit report and it is not an unqualified audit opinion.
I'm trying to link the heading and what is explained in here. It's confusing me. If we say it's a qualification, but then you say except for, but then what you are putting after except for is the error. How do you read it with the qualification? Because my little understanding is that then we should be saying unqualified except for these particular things. I think then it makes sense for me to follow that this opinion, if it was not those particular errors, then they will have a clean audit. But maybe this thing has not been crafted properly. I don't know.
I'm trying to link to the heading, the qualification with the brother's effect, and that's that line.
accountants.
That's why they have golf clashes between legal and accountants. Sort it out on the golf course. No. I think we must read, and I agree with you, it's not, the whole picture is not painted here, because when we express an audit opinion, we express an audit opinion on the entire set of financial statements. So we say, it's qualified, we have a heading saying qualified audit opinion, or qualified opinion, and we say that except for this area of the financial statements and that area of the financial statements, the rest of the financial statements are fairly presented. So you can rely on the rest of the financial set of financial statements, but except for this one and that one, you can't rely on it. Because we express an opinion on the entire set. So the entire set is not qualified. We will get to that scenario in a minute. It's only that portion and that portion that's qualified. So except for that, the rest are fine.
Now, the example you are giving, actually the word except for, it actually means qualified because of. What you actually list is actually those things that actually make the whole thing to be qualified. Is that the case?
Not the whole set of financial statements, but only those. So we would say,
yeah.
Except for, and if you could picture a set of financial statements that would have components in it, and it would have, for example, debtors. So we'll say, except for debtors, which is qualified, the rest of the financial statements are fairly presented.
That means the debtors are the ones that make the whole set to be qualified?
No, not the whole set of financial statements, but only the debtors is qualified. Only, so the financial statements, so creditors is fine, bank is fine, so it's only the debtors that we have a problem with materially.
I understand that, but what I'm saying is this opinion.
Yes.
So the opinion is the qualification.
Yes.
Because of the debt.
Yes.
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 That's what I'm saying. If I read the set for actually, it indicates those sessions that you are worried about. Okay, thanks.
Chairperson and members, now this is this one is bad because this one says that we disagree with everything in the financial statements, and so we cannot say that the financial statements as a whole fairly presents. So this is worse than just one part of the financial statements being qualified. This is the entire financial statement that we are saying it is not a fair presentation at all. So you cannot rely on the entire set of financial statements.
To you, Chair, are you saying to us when you give an adverse opinion is that that institution doesn't function according to the BFMA, the MMFA, according to what you want them to do, internal audit committees, all those things. Is that what you're saying, John?
No, it may be the entire ambit, it may be laws and regulations, etc., etc., but remembering, if I can take a look back to this depiction here, If we go back to the second block, which says report on financial statements, and the first bullet says indicates opinion on financial information. So these opinions are linked to the financial information. You with me? So you may have a situation where we issue an adverse audit opinion in terms of the financial statements, where we disagree with everything in the numbers, all the numbers. And by some miracle, it won't make sense, but it could be a miracle that there are no other matters of non-compliance and laws or regulations and internal control. But that's highly unlikely, but it could theoretically happen. So adverse opinion is we're saying the financial statements are not credible. The financial information in the financial statements are not credible. The worst opinion is where, and remembering that our audit process is a process of gathering evidence to support what management purports in terms of the financial statements. If we cannot gather that evidence to support what management is indicating in the financial statements, then we are unable to form an audit opinion because we could not get audit evidence that is appropriate and sufficient to support what management is saying. And then we issue a disclaimed audit opinion. In other words, I can't express an opinion because I've got nothing to express an opinion on, supporting documents, the like. Yeah. So that's a disclaimed audit opinion.
Yeah, but at the beginning when you were looking at the disclaimer, you were saying this is a worse situation. But is it worse than the adverse opinion? Because the adverse opinion, you have information, but which doesn't make sense at all. Mm. And this one of the disclaimers. The unfortunate thing is that we just simply don't have the documentation. The situation is that there's no information in front of you.
How that becomes more worse than the adverse opinion?
And that's why I think logically, if you want to know how much money I have, and I give you half of the money, then you are not able. And then the next time, I don't even give you my pet. Then how do you say the two and say the other one is hard?
Maybe I can eat. No, I fully understand. Understand what you're asking. With a disclaimed audit opinion, we're saying that in any process of putting together a set of financial statements, the process actually starts when you transact on a daily basis. Yeah. So you transact on a daily basis and you buy things and you make decisions and then you are required to keep that supporting documentation, and you're required to then record that information in your accounting books. And you need to do that on a monthly, on a daily basis, record it daily. And then on a monthly basis, as management, you're required to reconcile the books. And at the end of the year, you then look at all your reconciliations and you produce a set of financial statements. Now, when we disclaim, we're saying there's the financial statements, but there's no information to support how you got there. So in other words, you don't have a invoice to produce that supports the purchase of this computer, because right up front, that documentation is just not there. So in order to get the financial statements, you need to go through the series of processes. And if you don't have it at this stage, then how did it get there? And we just don't know. Yeah. But as opposed to an adverse, where we can see what you attempted to do, but it disagrees with either the accounting framework, which says when you buy this screen, it is an asset, and so you must account for it in a particular manner. Management may have said, I bought the screen, there's my invoice, but I accounted for it in a different manner to the accounting framework. Yeah, it's a consumer, absolutely correct. So then you can see, okay, it's a management decision which disagrees with the accounting policy, but at least you can understand what they did, which disagrees. If you have a disclaimer, you don't know how the information got there. That's why we term the disclaimer worse than the adverse.
Can they have a very suitable word instead of opinion? Because if you go to the law, opinion, you can define it somehow. Here, what I can understand is they talk about the evidence or this, the documentation, but this is opinion. I think if they can sit down and get a nice word in order to can clarify this thing, is it audit opinion? But you're talking about evidential value of the thing, of the documentation.
I think through you, Chair, the audit process and the product at the end of the day is not absolute assurance. It is reasonable assurance. It's reasonable assurance because we don't check everything. We only take a sample. So, in other words, there is a possibility, theoretically, that because of the sample nature and because we're providing reasonable assurance that something is missed. But the audit process attempts, if you follow the audit process appropriately, attempts to plug those gaps so that you don't miss big things. You may miss the small things, but you don't miss the big things. And you don't... Well, we're related to that magic word that we call materiality, that quantitative materiality. Qualitative also we consider to be material. But it's not absolute assurance, not because management, by virtue of the fact that they are the management of the entity, that they interact, transact on a daily basis, they make decisions, they're there every day, they're the ones that must give absolute assurance that the financial statements are free from material misstatement. That's their responsibility. Ours is giving reasonable assurance on a sample basis. It's a different scope. Forensics becomes factual then. Well, on a defined scope. So the scope is very defined. It would say, please determine whether that chair was purchased according to the procurement processes and whether the procurement person was involved in whatever. So the forensic nature or the nature of forensic audit will be very specific. So you can do 100%. Then the rest of the slides talks about our processes, our internal processes to prevent and reduce to zero the risk of expressing an incorrect audit opinion. Talks about the quality processes that we go through throughout the audit and post the audit. It talks about and I think this is the important slide in also in response to the member's question about that absolute assurance. This is the responsibility of management. This is what they need to do. They need to prepare the financial statements that are accurate. They need to ensure that internal controls are designed, implemented, and maintained to prevent things from going amiss. They require to select the accounting policies, and if I can relate that to the member's question about the adverse, if management selects an accounting policy that is contradictory to the accounting framework, then we're going to have a disagreement and then we're going to have an adverse audit opinion. So that's one of the examples, and it's a management responsibility, so that's why we will disagree and we'll have an adverse audit opinion. Management is required to disclose all non-compliance of laws and regulations. Management needs to monitor and report on performance information. Management also needs to provide access to the auditors. Identify, primary management responsibility, identify, prevent, detect, and disclose fraud. Account for and disclose related party transactions. develop and implement action plans to address audit findings and improve financial management and accountability. Those are all management functions. So just relate that to the other question that we had where we indicated when the member asked, what can we not do in terms of special audits? Any of these functions are management functions, and if we consider a special audit over and above the regularity audit, we cannot perform any of these management functions in essence. And the responsibility of the auditor is to remain independent through the process, to ensure leadership visibility throughout the audit process is maintained at all our auditees. We must ultimately determine whether the financial statements are free from material misstatement and provide reasonable assurance of that, do checks, test checks on amounts and disclosure in financial statements, consider the controlled environment in assessing risk, evaluate the adequacy and appropriateness of the accounting policies, evaluate whether financial statements are fairly presented, evaluate any non-compliance with laws and regulations, and evaluate controls regarding performance information. And finally, to assist leadership at all levels of the accountability chain, including the executive, to facilitate clean audit reports, our audit reports, management reports need to be clear and simple so that people understand what it is that needs to be fixed in order to move and improve on financial management and ultimately get to the clean audit report phase. Gee, I think that we can conclude on that unless there are other questions on the other slides. I don't know if members had an opportunity to read ahead. No, unfortunately not.
Can I just help with you? Because all of you at the institutions that are doing the financial statements are accountants or whatever, and even yourselves as well, you are accountants. And now, if you come to a situation where you are interpreting something differently, is the man from the Auditor General and the man from the institution similarly qualified? But then now they are interpreting one thing, one policy or whatever, differently. Whose word stands?
Through you, I think that's a very important question because although we're trained as accountants, the work we do is auditing. So we never profess to be expert accountants. We profess to be expert auditors. And if there is a disagreement, and normally what we tell our staff is that if the accounting standards say X and Y to get to Z, and it's clearly defined as such, then you take your finding and you report it. But if it says X, Y, to get to Z, follow B, and to get to B is fuzzy, and it's not clear, then we step back as accountants, as auditors, sorry, and we allow the accountants to decide on that gray area in the standards. The accountants in this regard will be provincial treasury and national treasury, because they set the accounting framework. And if there's a gray area in a standard, in an accounting standard, they must make the final call whether it is a grey area or not, and because they oversee the implementation of the accounting frameworks, they must discern whether the entity is allowed to do it or not. So unless it's black and white in the standards and everybody can see, a reasonable person can see, we will express our audit opinion. As soon as it becomes a grey area, we step back as auditors because we're not experts, and we allow the experts, provincial treasury, national treasury, to intervene and say that grey area is X and Y. So we maintain our independence as well, and we allow the accountant general and national treasury to do what they do and what they subject matter experts on.
Yeah, I was just thinking about if you misinterpret
Sana and expressed an adverse opinion, whereas it is actually on the basis of your own limited knowledge, and then and you portray the whole thing. That's what I was asking.
Through you to avoid that from, to prevent that from occurring, we've got, in our audit process, we've got various levels of review. So let's say a very junior official in our organization, we call them training auditors, if they make a mistake in interpretation, then we've got three levels of review to pick it up within the audit process. And secondly, we've got a pre-issuance process or quality control process, which means that before the audit report is signed, the audit process is subjected to an independent evaluation by a qualified person to determine whether the audit opinion is correct or the proposed audit opinion is, that's been, the proposed audit opinion is correct in terms of what we have done. And then after we issue the audit opinion, we've got a post quality control process, which says, which looks back and says, you've issued your audit opinion now. Did you do the right thing? So we've got various checks and balances, and it's a, and it is a requirement in the audit profession internationally to have these checks and balances in place. If one can just think of the Enron debacle, close to home, LeisureNet debacle, where the auditors were blamed. The audit fraternity has taken a pendulum swing to the other side and ensured that these processes are in place to prevent that incorrect audit opinion from being expressed.
Do you, as the Auditor General,
the office take CFOs on training courses to learn them and to teach them what to do the first time and to do it correct? That is now for departments. The other one is CFOs in municipalities. Because why are we talking year after year about the same thing?
We'd like to think that we do that indirectly by reporting very simply and clearly in our audit report and our management report and identifying the root causes that drive the audit findings. And so it's easy and simple for a CFO, municipal manager, to understand what needs to be done to fix. So that's where we see our role in facilitating the clean audit opinions. We cannot get involved in training CFOs and HODs, for that matter, because there's an independence issue. If I, for argument's sake, train a CFO and say, this is an asset, and or this is a consumable, and it should be an asset, I can't come back and audit him and say, but I told you this is a consumable, why did you raise it as an asset? You know, there's an independence issue there. So what we do is, when we identify the root causes for our entities, we compile what we call a general report. That takes all of the, let's talk about the Western Cape, you know, 30 municipalities in the Western Cape and 3 municipal entities. So we take the findings of those 30 municipalities and 3 municipal entities and we converge it into an annual report, or general report, sorry, where we look at the province as a whole, taking the detail from the city and those 3. Then we look at who can assist in the context of the province. So we raise the bar in terms of the findings and the root causes so that the Premier knows what the Premier's function is in improving the audit outcomes, so that Provincial Treasury knows what their responsibility is in improving the audit outcomes, so that the MEC of Finance and the MEC of Local Government understand. And why I'm deliberately saying this is Provincial Treasury then understands that if we've identified finance units that, and I hate to use this word because we don't couch it that way, but let's say there's a lack of skill and competence in municipalities, we can link that to the findings in the audit report, then we say very clearly, provincial treasury, you need to get involved. National treasury, you need to get involved. MECs, you need to get involved in freeing up vacant posts, etc., etc.
Thanks, gentlemen. Through you, Chair, in the previous committee, I happened to be there as the secretary, where one of the provinces we visited, municipalities were complaining that at some stage the AG uses consultants in terms of auditing. Is this still the case, or are you aware of that?
Through your chair, I tend to support the chairperson when he says why a person, or right, a municipality get an advert audit year after year, whereas they had a basis. The first one is a basis to start on and improve from there. Why it is like that?
Chief, through you, I think the answer lies, Anton Member, in these three key areas. If I can find it. There we are. The answer lies in the third row, which talks about internal controls, leadership, financial management and performance management units, and governance. Any finding related to an entity can be allocated to any one of those three or all three, in essence. So, as an example, we spoke about as part of our responsibilities to, as part of management's responsibilities to follow up on the recommendations that the Auditor General made in the previous year's audit. Now, we evaluate that in the next year, and we find that either the plans that have been crafted are not adequate, the plans that have crafted have not allocated resources and responsibilities to a particular item, or the timelines are just not realistic to influence the next financial year. And that as an example, is a leadership function. The leadership must drive the implementation and the monitoring of that action plan. And you're quite correct. Year after year after year, we report in some instances the same findings, and it can only be categorized into any one of those three areas, the findings. To address the member's question, Chair, we make use of consultants in two areas. The first area is our model as such, our strategic model, if I can put it this way, is such that we don't want to employ, we don't want to capacitate ourselves to perform all the audits ourselves, because it won't be effective in terms of our model. So what we've decided was that a benchmark of 20% of our total number of hours that we need to perform, we will contract out to private audit firms. But that contract out process doesn't mean that we take the audit, give it to them, and let them do exactly as they please. We are still, in terms of the arrangement, we still sign off on the audit report, which means that we need to be involved at every level of interaction and process through their audit process, so that at the end of the day when we sign off, we know that we can put pen to paper. So in that regard, we still make use of private audit firms. We are trying to benchmark and achieve a benchmark of 20% in relation to how much we farm out to contract workers. But they're part of our organization. They become part of our organization for that period. So we train them. We invite them to our training presentations. We share all our information with them. We monitor them very closely and regularly. We interact with them on a daily basis, etc. So that we can't just let them be. The other area where we may use consultants is where we need to express an opinion or we need to rely on the work of experts. So, for example, if an engineer decided that it would cost X amount of money to build this bridge, we can either bring in our own engineer or we can evaluate the process by which the engineer that the municipality used, whether that process was airtight to get to the final number of the bridge. So in those two instances, but preferably we use consultants, so contractors, to assist and augment our audit, our staff establishment, so that we can complete all our audits within the legislated time frame. But having said that, there's a responsibility on our side to ensure that they do what we want them to do.
Thank you.
No, definitely. There are risks, and that's why we do have the processes in place. Definitely.
Mr. Witters, Mr. Diedrich, Mr. Rainey, Mr. Adams, thank you for your presentations today. We will now adjourn this meeting and convene again tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock. The line in the same venue. 10 o'clock until 1. And then you would like to hear when the training session will be here.
What is that?
Thank you.